You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the December 12, 2018 edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Before getting into today's program, I want to let you know that at 5:15 this afternoon, there will be a meeting of the KZYX Board of Directors at 564 South Dora Street in Ukiah. Those attending should use the side entrance off the driveway. Okay, now on with the show. On Friday night, Consortium News hosted an unusual video program, a three-hour online vigil for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, hosted by Consortium News chief editor Joe Loria, and featuring, among others, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, former New York Times correspondent Chris Edges, and famed whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. The vigil was intended to call attention to the plight of Assange, who appears to be on the verge of being evicted from the Ecuadorian embassy in London and extradited to the U.S. to face charges of espionage. Assange's crimes? Exposing ugly and uncomfortable truths about U.S. foreign policy and military actions going back to the beginning of the Iraq War and extending to the release of the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta's emails in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election that revealed, among other things, the party's leadership's determination to sabotage the campaign of Bernie Sanders. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking again with Consortium News' Joe Loria about the smear campaign that has been launched against Assange to tie him into Trump's Russiagate woes and undermine public support for the embattled publisher. So stay tuned for that. Regular listeners to Takes on the World are aware that I spend an inordinate amount of time speaking about the influence of the pro-Israel lobby on our U.S. political system and on the media. As I've explained before, I do that for a specific reason. It's simply because what I report to you about the lobby's activities, while fully reported in the Israeli press and the American Jewish press, is generally censored in the U.S. media, and that includes New York Times and other leading print media and on air, all the TV networks, plus NPR and even Democracy Now! Take the case, for example, of Rand Paul, the junior senator from Kentucky. For more than 2 weeks, he has been holding up a vote by the full Senate on two bills which, like every piece of legislation favoring Israel, enjoy wide bipartisan backing. The first is for an act which authorizes and would establish as U.S. law $38 billion in free weapons to Israel over the next 10 years that had been negotiated by President Obama with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Obama's last year in office, which represented the greatest gift by U.S. taxpayers to any foreign country in our history. The other bill expresses approval of the state and local measures that have already been passed that deny government contracts to businesses that boycott Israel and would add federal penalties to the charges. 24 states, including California, have already passed such legislation, but unless you heard it from me when Sacramento approved it and Governor Brown signed it, this is probably news to you. What Rand Paul is taking advantage of is a little-known rule that enables a single senator to hold up a vote on a piece of legislation if he or she doesn't like it. It isn't used very often, but in this case, the mainstream media has chosen to ignore what should be a big story, while pro-Israel lobbying groups, AIPAC, and CUFI, that's Christians United for Israel, have launched all-out campaigns targeting Kentucky voters in an effort to pressure Paul to release his holds. So far, it hasn't worked. The editors of the Weekly Standard, the neocon house organ founded by William Kristol, criticized the senator's position, stating, Rand Paul and other opponents of the anti-boycott bill say they're worried it runs afoul of the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of speech. But the right to free speech does not entail a right to government contracts, end quote. Legislation had drawn sharp criticism from the ACLU and other civil liberties groups last year, describing it as a threat to free speech. In response, the bill's author, Ben Cardin from Maryland, who serves as Israel's chief point man in the Senate, then modified it so businesses found in violation of legislation will only be fined and not have its CEOs sent to prison as the original legislation intended. One can imagine what South Africa would be like today if it had had a lobby even half as powerful as Israel's. Closer to home, in the closing minutes of the Ukiah City Council meeting last Wednesday, there was an echo of Donald Trump's prioritizing the usefulness of Saudi Arabia over downgrading relations with the oil-rich monarchy over Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's role in the murder and dismemberment of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. By a 4-1 vote, with former mayor and KZYX program host Steve Scalmanini being the lone dissenter, the Ukiah City Council rejected my objections as a resident of Ukiah to the city purchasing a backhoe and loader manufactured by the Caterpillar Company for use by city employees. Since 2005, Caterpillar has been the target of an international boycott and investment campaign in response to its ongoing sale to Israel, paid for by U.S. taxpayers, of its gigantic P-9 bulldozers, which have been exclusively been used by the Israeli military to demolish Palestinian homes and greenhouses and rip up orchards of fruit and olive trees, many of them centuries old. In 2003, you may recall, one such bulldozer, driven by an Israeli soldier, while seeing her clearly, ran over and crushed to death 23-year-old Rachel Corey as she tried to prevent another home in Gaza from being reduced to rubble. That I posed their vote on the issue as a moral one as opposed to being a routine business decision was not appreciated by the Ukiah City Council majority as it began its new term. November 29th was the 71st anniversary of the United Nations General Assembly vote that called for partitioning Palestine into two states, with 55% and the coastline going to the Jews, who represented 30% of the population, and 45% to the Arabs, who rejected it. On the anniversary of that date, over many decades, the UN has been the site of a memorial conference which was seen as a launching pad for one of the great crimes of the crime-filled 20th century, the ethnic cleansing of 750,000 Palestinians from their homeland. That the partition vote, which the Palestinians found unacceptable, came just 2 years after the revelations of another monstrous crime, Hitler's attempt to exterminate the Jews of Europe, is one of history's great ironies and explains why the conflict between Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs is still very much with us today. For the mainstream media, however, only the Israeli narrative is acceptable. This is what Temple University Mark Lamont Hill, who spoke at this year's Convocation for Palestine, learned the hard way when he was fired as a CNN commentator for comments made that were not acceptable to the Take No Prisoners censors of the Israel lobby. In his speech, Hill, an African-American, had the temerity to point out that the Palestinians, under harsh military occupation in the West Bank and for all intents and purposes in Gaza for the past 51 years, have, under international law, every right to resist the occupation with armed struggle. While pointing out that fact, Hill didn't endorse it. Hill sealed his fate when, concluding his talk, he invoked a common Palestinian dream of a better future, saying, quote, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," end quote. Acknowledging the Palestinians' legal right to take up arms against the Israeli occupiers and calling for freedom for Palestinians is, for the Israel lobby's watchdogs, tantamount to calling for the genocide of the Jewish people, and 24 hours later, Hill, a paid CNN correspondent, was fired. That the accusations against Hill were unfounded is evident to anyone willing to watch his 21-minute, 7-second talk that can be found on YouTube. But there should be no question as to who is pulling the strings of the mainstream media. Though the chair of Temple University's board ripped into Hill yesterday, the university announced it will not punish Hill for his comments. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education reports that after meeting with the school's board of trustees yesterday, Temple President Richard Englert released a statement noting Mark Lamont Hill, will neither be punished nor investigated for his comments. Englert said the professor, quote, spoke as a private citizen and his right to do so is protected by the Constitution, end quote. I have a hunch that will not be the end of it. In all the remembrances of the departed George H.W. Bush, there was one I was sure would be overlooked, except in the Israeli and American Jewish press, despite it being one of the main reasons, if not the main reason, he failed to win re-election in 1992. Bush Sr. was the last president to stand up to Israel. Having gone on national television on September 12, 1991, at a moment when both houses of Congress were ready to override the veto of Israel's request for $10 billion in loan guarantees. 1,000 pro-Israel lobbyists were on Capitol Hill to make sure it would happen against, as Bush described it, one lonely guy. Bush told the American people why he was opposing getting the loan guarantees and how much aid each Israeli man, woman, and child was getting from the U.S. taxpayer. And that stopped AIPAC and Congress in its tracks. One Senator, Barbara Mikulski, a co-sponsor of legislation, was meeting with 60 of the lobbyists when, as Larry Kohler wrote in the Washington Jewish Week, quote, "The meeting was interrupted when an aide to Mikulski handed her a note. Mikulski's face went ashen. She turned to the group and uttered the last thing they wanted to hear. 'I've just learned,' she said, 'the president has said he is taking his case for a 120-day delay to the American people,'" end quote. Imagine that, taking the issue to the American people. How dare he do such a thing? Well, the very next day, the head of AIPAC, Tom Dine, told the press, quote, "September 12, 1991 is a day that will live in infamy," end quote. But as Israel's Daily Haaretz recalled last week, Bush's public appeal for support worked. Polls at the time found that 86% of Americans agreed with the president's call for the loan guarantee delay. And major U.S. media backed his stance, with both the New York Times and Washington Post running editorials favoring his position, end quote. That was from Haaretz last week. What the article did not say was that 4 months later, Bush would again refuse to approve the guarantees because Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir would not agree to bar Russian Jews from settling in the West Bank and Gaza. By then, the Republican establishment and its pundits in the media had turned against Bush, blaming him for the country's economic downturn. Support for Israel had trumped their loyalty to their party and their president. In the end, after Shamir was forced to resign and was replaced by Yitzhak Rabin, Bush agreed to the loan guarantees with the caveat that any of the guaranteed loans spent settling Jews in the occupied territories would be deducted from the amount guaranteed. Bill Clinton, who would defeat him, soon reversed that restriction, permitting Israel to settle Russian Jews to settle anywhere it pleased without charging the loan guarantees. It's not inappropriate to mention that the first person Clinton hired to run his presidential campaign was a former staff member of AIPAC. Ireland, which had six centuries of experience battling British colonialism, has become the first country to push through a bill that will criminalize the import of goods from Israeli settlements and impose a 5-year jail sentence or a 283,000 euro fine on anyone found guilty of profiting from illegal settlement industries. The bill passed last Thursday will ban the import or sale of goods or services from settlements regarded as illegal under international law. The legislation, which passed in the Synod, a branch of the country's legislature, and approved without a vote, was met with sustained applause and a standing ovation by opposition senators. The bill makes an offense, quote, "for a person to import or attempt to import settlement goods," end quote, "or to assist anyone in doing so." The measure now needs the endorsement of the lower house of the parliament, known as the Dáil Éireann, before the Irish president can sign it into law. However, it's likely to face stiff resistance, according to the Irish Times, since the government is said to be reluctant to push the legislation further. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. We begin this morning with a long look at Palestine's premier institution of higher learning, Birzeit University. Palestinians are among the highest educated people on the face of the earth. That is the good news. The bad news is that after they get their many degrees, whether it be a BA or a master's degree or a PhD or whatever, there are few jobs and extremely limited opportunities in their field for them when they finish. However, despite the grim economic and career opportunities, Palestinians highly value education, and families go to extraordinary sacrifices to educate their children. It's an amazing phenomenon for a country living under military occupation. And Birzeit University? It is rated in the top 3% of universities in the world. How's that for an amazing statistic? Here is the president of Birzeit, Dr. Abdulatif Abuhilyev, tell us about the university and the vital role it plays in Palestinian society. He speaks at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Mohammed. I'm glad to be here again. Thank you, Mr. Rabi, for inviting me to talk about the education in general in Palestine and specifically in Birzeit University. I will say that Birzeit University is the leading institution of the higher education in Palestine. I will give a short history of the university when it started as elementary school in 1924. It was established by a lady called Nabiha Nasser from the town of Birzeit, and she established this elementary school for girls at that time in 1924. And a lot of Palestinians used to come actually to Birzeit school. And George, now he reminded me that he got some education in Birzeit school, not a university, I mean, in maybe, I don't know, in the 40s or 50s, in the 30s. And yeah, then this school, I mean, developed into a college in the 50s and the 60s. And this college used to offer, after, you know, it was upgraded to a college, it used to offer 2 years education to Palestinians and some of the Arabs from the Gulf area, from Jordan, from Syria, Lebanon used to come and get some education 2 years in this 2 years college. They used to call it Birzeit College, actually. This is in the 50s and during the 50s and the 60s. After the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza in 1967, the people who were the founders actually of Birzeit School and Birzeit College, they start thinking that why the young men and women of Palestinians should go abroad and get their degrees from outside. We want to keep these kids inside the country. Maybe we, as a Palestinian, we learned our lesson not to leave home after 1948. And this is one of the good lessons we learned. And I will tell you now, the population of the Palestinians inside the historical Palestine is 6.6 million. I mean, more than half of the Palestinians are still living in Palestine. Yes, it is 6.6 million, including, I mean, the inhabitants of the West Bank, in the Gaza, and the Palestinians inside Israel. This is 6.6. Just for comparison, for not for anything else, the Jews, which we don't like to classify people, Muslims, Jews, Christians, but anyway, inside historical Palestine, it's also 6.5 to 6.6, which means now the Palestinians and the Israel or the Jews actually 50-50 inside Palestine. Yes, and this is one of the important, I believe myself, that the universities, which Birzeit played a tremendous role in keeping the Palestinian people and especially the young Palestinians inside Palestine by offering the higher education in the university. The Birzeit turned upgraded to a university in 1972 after the occupation of the West Bank in 1967. Before that, I mean, those students who graduated from Birzeit College having these 2 years of education used to go to the American University in Beirut and get their bachelor degree in whatever area they, and some of you maybe know that, and we still have a good relationship with the American University in Beirut. Then Birzeit became a university in 1972, and since then it developed into, I would say now, to a comprehensive university. Almost we have more than 100 programs. We offer bachelor degrees in about 75 bachelor degree programs. We have about 35 master's programs in different area. And we only have one PhD program, which is in social sciences. But the undergraduate programs, as I said, generally we offer bachelor's in different areas. It's a comprehensive university, except medicine. We don't have a school of medicine or a faculty of medicine yet, but we have other things. I mean, we have PharmD, we have nursing, we have nutrition, of course, science, engineering, whatever. And now we have our student body is about 14,000. It is not the largest university in the West Bank and Gaza or in Palestine. It is the oldest and the first Palestinian university. We are proud that our international ranking, this is lately in the last 2 years, put us as one of the top 3% of the universities around the world. I mean, this ranking is, yes, we are one of the top 3% out of, I mean, 26,000 universities they ranked around the world. It's Birzeit, people look at it as, you know, really is the leading institution in the West Bank in terms of educating people. And we have over 38,000 graduates now, graduated from Birzeit University. They are spread all over the world. And we are proud of our graduates. many of the leaders of the Palestinian authorities are graduates of Beer Sheva University. These years where university developed into a comprehensive university, we received a lot of support. I mean, financially and other supports from our friends inside and outside Palestine. I'll give you just, I don't have a picture of the campus or of photos, but we have brochures. I don't know if we can distribute them. This is one, I mean, this is part of the campus Beer Sheva has. It's a very nice campus. We almost have about 30 buildings. I'm proud to say that these 30 buildings are donated by the Palestinians in diaspora and from inside. And, I mean, each building costs not less than $3 million, I mean, which means an individual Palestinian, like the latest, the one who is building the last faculty or the recent faculty we are having is the Faculty of Arts, Music, and Design. And the building is donated for over $3 million. It's donated by Samira Weda, who is from Jerusalem, actually, originally. And he's a businessman in the Gulf area in Dubai. And he donated this over $3 million to build this building. And the building we inaugurated recently, one of the buildings, is the building for the law and public administration, is also donated by Palestinians. His name is Riyad Sadiq, for over $4 million. And so on. We have a faculty of engineering, which has all kind of engineering degrees. It's been donated by Sheikh Omar Al-Aqqad. He's a Palestinian from Java. And he donated over $5 million in the 80s, actually. This school of engineering has been built in 1979, 1980. And it was donated by one Palestinian, his name is School of Engineering, Omar Al-Aqqad School of Engineering, is one Palestinian at that time, donated over $5 million to build this Faculty of Engineering. The reason that people, they believe really in Beer Sheva University, that this is the leading institutions of the higher education, and they took this lead, and it really played and still playing an essential role in the Palestinian society. We have 9 faculties, as I said, except medicine. But in addition to the 9 faculties, we have 11 centers and institutions, center and institutes. And these centers and institutes, they are serving the community. I mean, this is one of our main mission, is to keep in touch with the Palestinian community, serve them, help them, and in many aspects. For example, we have a center of health education. This center do a lot of research related to the health of the Palestinians inside Palestine and outside Palestine. And every year we held a conference in Beer Sheva or outside Beer Sheva. Last year we held a conference in the American University in Beirut. And the main topic of the institute was, we were talking about the health of the Palestinian inside the West Bank and in Lebanon, for example. Yes, we do have communications with other Palestinian brothers in Lebanon, in Jordan, and so on. Beer Sheva has, we are not isolated, actually, from the international community. We have a lot of programs in coordination with the mainly European universities, I would say. Because in Europe, they have so many programs, higher education programs. One of them, they call it Erasmus Plus. Erasmus Plus, this is a European program that European universities can have, they can build a graduate or undergraduate program with universities in the Middle East, that Bir Zeit can join with the University of Jordan, with the University of, for example, of Rome or whatever. These three universities, for example, they can have mobility of the students in and out from Palestine, which is very important for us, that our students, they have to go outside Palestine or, and to see how other universities functions. And we would like, I mean, we receive also an academicians from Europe. I mean, they can come and spend a few weeks or a month or so on. I mean, we have some connections. Most of our communication and connections in terms of higher education is with Europe. As a Bir Zeit University, we try to have a consortium, actually. We did have one, and it is not very active. We need to activate it, where Bir Zeit is a part of a consortium with American University in Beirut, American University in Cairo, and American University of in Sharjah, I think, and University of California at Davis. Yes, we have this consortium, and we meet every 1 or 2 years. One of the projects we are having related to environment and energy. And actually, it's been supported by a Palestinians in Dubai. I mean, this consortium and the research we are doing together is being supported by a Palestinian who is a businessman also in the Gulf area. In addition to the, as I said, to these faculties we are having and centers and institutions, we at Bir Zeit University took, offered the Palestinian Authority 20 acres of land and to build a technopark. A technopark, it's a science park where young Palestinians from Bir Zeit and other Palestinian universities can come and do their, it's an innovation center, and it's a center for these youngs that they can start ups, they can start their own companies. We want to connect them. I mean, the idea is to connect the academia with the market, with the business, and with the industry. This is the science park, which is being donated by the Indians, actually. The Indians donated $12 million for the Palestinian Authority, actually, to build this science park. But the Palestinian Authority, they says Bir Zeit is the one who is qualified to run this science park. And actually, the president of the Bir Zeit University is the chairman of the board of this science park. And we are building now. We did not start yet, functionings, but almost we finished from the buildings. And this is another thing we are doing for our society. I don't know. I think I give you this is a brief information about the university. Of course, let me mention this. This is important. Bir Zeit campus has been closed 15 times by the Israeli military. The latest or the longest closure was during the first intifada from 1988 to 1992. The campus was completely closed by the Israelis during these 4 years. We have to move next to Bir Zeit town. There is the city is Ramallah. And we have to move to Ramallah, and we rented houses, apartments. We used to teach in our apartments, in our homes, and so on for 4 years, just to continue. Yes, we were not allowed to enter the campus. The campus was completely closed. This is the longest. Of course, during these closures, they used to close it for 2 months, 3 months, and so on. And we open again, and so on. But this was the largest one. Now we have some of our faculty members. Some of them, they are Palestinian origins. They hold, many of them, an American passports. They used to come to Birzeit, I mean, and we offer them a contract for 1 year, and they usually take this contract and show it to the civil, they call it civil administration of the Israeli civil administration, and they used to give them a 1 year visa to stay because they have to. In the last year, actually, some of them, they start, actually, they deny renewal of some of these visas to some of these faculty members. And 7 of them now are going maybe to leave if the Israelis will not renew their entry visas. And this is one of the difficulties we are facing, you know. Internationalization these days is very important for the faculty members and for students. And this is one of the things we want to bring, not only the Palestinians in diaspora, no, we want to bring our colleagues and academics from the United States, from Europe, and from everywhere, because we have to be part of the international community. And this is one of the main missions of any university, is to be part of the academic life of the universities around the world. I mean, cooperation between universities are essential for all. I mean, for students, for faculties, for the society, and so on.
That was Dr. Abdullatif Abu Hilya, president of Birzeit University, speaking in Washington, D.C. And now for something completely different. Our next presentation explores the early development of the relationship between the CIA and the Israeli Mossad. Jefferson Morley speaks about his research, which led to a book on James Angleton, who was the key person early on in the creation of the CIA and the person most responsible in forging the close ties between the intelligence forces in the U.S. and Israel. This is quite a story, so hang on. Here is investigative reporter and author Jefferson Morley speaking to an audience in Washington, D.C.
So Jefferson Morley will speak first, and he'll talk about the CIA and Mossad, trade-offs in the formation of the U.S.-Israel strategic relationship. Jefferson Morley is a veteran Washington investigative reporter and the author of The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton, which is flying off the shelves of our Middle East Books and More bookshelves. He'll be signing his books at 5 o'clock. His latest must-read book sheds new light on Angleton's close relationship with Israeli intelligence, citing such cases as Israel's 1967 attack on the USS Liberty and the diversion of U.S. government-owned weapons-grade uranium from Apollo PA to Israel in the 60s. A native of Minneapolis, Morley attended Yale University and worked as an editor at The New Republic, The Nation, and Spin magazine before joining The Washington Post in 1992, where he worked for 15 years. His reporting has appeared in The New York Review of Books, Reader's Digest, The New York Times Book Review, Rolling Stone, The Los Angeles Times, The American Prospect, and Salon. You are going to want to buy his book after hearing his talk. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Delinda, and thank you all for coming. Thanks to Grant for inviting me. Thank you, Gideon, Nora, and Ali, who I made friends with for the first time last night. Thank you for being my friends. This is my first time at this conference, and everybody has made me feel very welcome. Thanks to our live stream audience for paying attention. Please share this video on social media. You have your orders. Push that thumbs up button early and often. Since the publication last October of The Ghost, my biography of James Angleton, I've spoken to many people all over the country about this protean, unique, and some would say sinister character. But I don't think I've ever spoken to a group this large, so thank you all for coming. If you do like this talk, I hope you will buy the book. In fact, I've been told that it's an iron law of this conference that if you like the book, you are obliged to purchase the book. So I'll be signing here afterwards, and you know what to do. James Angleton's story is a story for the ages, but it's also a story of our time. And I want to emphasize that in sketching a little bit about him personally, and especially the very earliest days of the U.S.-Israeli relationship. When I started writing The Ghost in January 2015, the term the deep state was pretty much unknown publicly, save to a handful of political scientists. And when I finished the book 2 years later in the spring of 2017, I was informed by an ABC News poll that 48% of Americans agreed that there is such a thing as the deep state, which was defined as military or intelligence officials who secretly manipulate U.S. policy. I realized that Angleton, who was a cold warrior and a zealous defender of America's leadership role in the post-war world, was also an avatar of this so-called deep state. And I don't mean that in a kind of conspiratorial or spooky way. I mean that in a very specific and concrete way. Angleton embodied and shaped the CIA's operational ethos and its internal procedures, especially in the realm of counterintelligence. His theories of Soviet penetration dominated the thinking of Western intelligence agencies, and their legacy can even be seen in the counterintelligence investigation into the Trump campaign and allegations of collusion with Russia. I want to emphasize that I only use the term deep state as a colloquial shorthand term for the array of U.S. national security agencies that operate under the shroud of official secrecy. And let's not forget, there are at least a dozen such agencies based here in Washington. The CIA, with its $15 billion a year budget, is the largest. The NSA, with a budget of about $10 billion, is second largest. The Defense Intelligence Agency is about $4 billion. And then along with some other obscure but still very large agencies like the NGIA. Never heard of the NGIA? I didn't think so. The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency is a $4.9 billion a year agency. Collectively, these agencies spend probably $50 to $60 billion a year, which make them a very small but powerful, potent sector in the American scheme of power. Want to know how the NGIA spent your $4.9 billion? Good luck. Want to see a line item budget of CIA activities in Africa last year? You know, move along. It's true that Congress nominally has oversight powers over these agencies. Our elected officials do have the security clearances that we don't have, so they can go in and look at selected operations. But the intelligence oversight system is very weak, as even its defenders will admit. The intelligence committees, polarized and politicized, can't even agree on what kind of secret activities they're supposed to monitor. The FISA court system is supposed to protect Americans from surveillance by their government, but it largely functions as a rubber stamp of the secret agencies. Secret government is the norm in America in 2018, which is why the discourse of the deep state has such currency today. Angleton, I'm going to put to you, was a founding father of what we call the deep state. So who was he? Born in December 1917, James Angleton grew up as the oldest son of James Hugh Angleton, a brash, self-made American businessman who moved to Milan, Italy during the Depression and made a fortune during the time of Benito Mussolini selling cash registers. Angleton attended private school in England. He went to Yale College and then to Harvard Law School. He was a precocious, good-looking young man with sophisticated manners and a literary frame of mind. As an undergraduate, he befriended his fellow expatriate Ezra Pound in Italy. Pound was the modernist poet and the mad tribune of Mussolini's fascism. In their correspondence, which I found at Yale, Angleton sometimes aped the anti-Semitic rhetoric of Ezra Pound, for example, criticizing the Jewish book merchants who he thought overcharged for Pound's books. In 1943, Angleton was recruited into the Office of Strategic Services, America's first foreign intelligence service. Stationed in Rome during and after World War II, he excelled at secret intelligence work. I tell the story in The Ghost of how he rescued a leading Nazi and a leading Italian fascist from post-war justice. Among other tasks, he reported on the flow of Jews escaping from Germany and heading for Palestine. The revelations of the Holocaust transformed his attitudes towards, transformed his disdain for Jews into something of sympathy. He began to develop sources among the leaders of the Jewish and Zionist organizations, including Teddy Kollek, who was a British intelligence agent, and a German operative named Arthur Peer, who later became known as Asher Ben Natan. With the passage of the National Security Act in July 1947, Angleton went to work at the CIA. The CIA came into existence, and Angleton became the chief of the Foreign Intelligence Staff with responsibility for intelligence collection operations worldwide. In those days, the CIA was right here in the heart of Washington. It's hard for people to believe now, but the CIA was located in a series of temporary buildings located along the reflecting pool next to the Lincoln Memorial. The tempos, as they were called by CIA people, were drafty in the winter, hot in the summer, and devoid of charm year-round. But this is where the Angleton worked at what was known as the Office of Special Operations. Angleton, while sympathetic to Jewish suffering, was still very wary of Israel when he started his career at the CIA. Before the 1948 war, the Jewish army had been largely armed by Czech arms manufacturers in communist Czechoslovakia. The Soviet Union was the first country to recognize the state of Israel in 1948. And Angleton initially feared that the Soviets would use Israel as a platform for injecting spies into the West. The Israelis, for their part, were looking to cultivate American friends. Stalin's anti-Semitic purges in 1948 showed that his allegiance to the Jewish state was superficial at best. In 1950, a man named Reuven Shiloah, the founder of Israel's first intelligence organization, came to Washington, and he visited the CIA, and he came away very impressed with how it was organized. He went back to Israel, and in April 1951, he created, out of a very fractious collection of security forces, what was known as the Institute for Intelligence and Special Tasks, inevitably known as Mossad, Hebrew for Institute. In 1951, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion came to the United States and brought Shiloah with him. Ben-Gurion met privately with President Truman, and Angleton arranged for Ben-Gurion to also have lunch with his friend Alan Dulles, who would shortly become the director of the CIA. The purpose of this meeting, Ephraim Halevi, a retired director of the Mossad and a longtime friend of Angleton's, told me in an interview in Tel Aviv, the purpose was, in Halevi's words, to clarify in no uncertain terms that notwithstanding what had happened between Israel and the United States in 1948, and notwithstanding that Russia had been a key factor in Israel's survival, Israel considered itself part of the Western world and would maintain the relationship with the United States in this spirit. Shiloah stayed on in Washington to work out the arrangements with Angleton. Shiloah, according to his biographer, soon developed a special relationship, quote unquote, and Angleton became the CIA's exclusive liaison with the Mossad in 1951. Angleton returned the favor by traveling to Israel often. He was introduced to Amos Manor, chief of counterespionage for Israel's domestic security service, known as Shabak or Shin Bet. Manor headed up Operation Balsam, which was the Israelis' conduit to the Americans. Quote, They told me I had to collect information about the Soviet bloc and transmit it to them, Manor recalled about the Americans. I didn't know exactly what to do, but I had the idea of giving them material we had gathered a year earlier about the efforts of the Eastern Bloc to use Israel to bypass an American trade embargo. We edited the material and informed them that they should never ask us to identify our sources. From such arrangements, the CIA-Mossad relationship began to grow. Manor would be friends with Angleton for the rest of his life. In 1963, a man named Isser Harel was succeeded as the chief of Mossad by a military intelligence officer named Meir Amit. Amit found Angleton to be a little eccentric, but he noted that his, quote, identification with Israel was a great asset for Israel. Asher Ben-Natan, Angleton's source dating back to the OSS days, was playing a key procurement role in the secret Israeli program to obtain nuclear weapons. Teddy Kollek, one of Angleton's closest contacts and friends in Washington, later became the mayor of Jerusalem. Angleton's Israeli friends, in short, were really the architects, some of the architects of the Zionist state. As I came to learn this story from talking to CIA veterans and Israelis and reading a lot, a couple of things stood out to me. First of all, the Israeli recruitment of Angleton was extremely astute. In the early 1950s, Angleton was a rising star at this new agency, the CIA, but he was not a senior figure and not even particularly powerful. The Israelis recognized the latent qualities that would make him powerful. Second, Angleton's creative intellect and his operational audacity inspired deep feelings of loyalty among the Israelis. While Angleton's counterintelligence vision would become very controversial within and bitterly divisive within the CIA, he was widely admired in Israel as a stalwart friend, and he still is to this day. In 1954, Angleton became the chief of the CIA's counterintelligence staff, the first one. In 1956, Amos Manor passed him a copy of Nikita Khrushchev's secret speech to the Soviet Communist Party, in which he criticized the cult of personality around the deceased dictator Joseph Stalin. This intelligence coup made Angleton a legend within the CIA and a power within the agency as well, and it was very much made possible by the Israelis. Angleton's formative and sometimes decisive influence on U.S. policy towards Israel can be seen in many areas, from the impotence of U.S. nuclear nonproliferation policy in the region to Israel's triumph in the 1967 Six-Day War to the feeble U.S. response to the attack on the Liberty, to the intelligence failure represented by the Yom Kippur War of 1973. I tell a lot of this story in The Ghost, but the story of Angleton and Israel is really so large and so profound that it probably deserves its own book. I could certainly not do justice to it in the 18 minutes that I have, so I'm going to confine myself to one narrow question about the trade-offs that became implicit in this agreement, in this arrangement between the CIA and the Mossad, and its implications for us. And the question, which was put to me by Grant, but is right on point, was why didn't the CIA help the FBI investigate the diversion of U.S. weapons-grade material from the United States to Israel in the 1960s and 1970s? And the short answer is because Jim Angleton didn't want to. Angleton played a key role in enabling Israel to obtain nuclear weapons, and he did so in a subtle way that characteristically left few fingerprints. He was not a man to investigate himself. Many of these details are now known, thanks to Grant Smith, Roger Mattson, John Haddon Jr., and others. I want to just give you a sense of how this transpired. So the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation, otherwise known as NUMEC, started processing highly enriched uranium in the United States in 1959. NUMEC had been created by David Lowenthal, a Zionist financier who financed the post-war boat lift from Europe to Palestine that was romanticized in the book and movie Exodus. He hired Zalman Shapiro, a brilliant young metallurgist, to run the company. At that time, the U.S. government owned all of supplies of nuclear fuel, which private companies like NUMEC were allowed to use, but ultimately had to return to the government. Within a few years, the Atomic Energy Commission noticed worrisome signs that the Apollo plant, NUMEC had a plant in Apollo, Pennsylvania, that the plant's security and accounting were very deficient. Unexplained losses did happen, of nuclear material did happen at other companies, but NUMEC's losses were proportionally much larger. By October 1965, the AEC estimated that 178 kilograms of highly enriched uranium had gone missing from the NUMEC facility. By March 1968, that figure was 267 kilograms. John Haddon was the CIA station chief in Israel from 1964 to 1967 and worked very closely with Angleton throughout this period. And he would later concur with the near-unanimous assessment of CIA's nuclear scientists that Israel had indeed stolen fissile material from NUMEC and used it to build their nuclear arsenal. This story is now very well documented. In the spring of 1965, a technician working at the night shift at NUMEC went out on a loading dock for a breath of fresh air and saw an unusual sight. Zalman Shapiro was pacing on the dock while a foreman and truck driver loaded cylindrical storage containers known as stovepipes onto a flatbed truck. The technician saw a clipboard saying that the material was destined for Israel. It was highly unusual to see Dr. Shapiro in the manufacturing section of the Apollo nuclear facility, the technician said. It was unusual to see Dr. Shapiro there at night, and it was very unusual to see Dr. Shapiro so nervous. The next day, NUMEC's personnel manager visited the technician and threatened to fire him if he did not keep his mouth shut, that's a quote, concerning what it would be seen, what he had seen. It would be 15 years before the employee told the story to the FBI. What did Angleton know about NUMEC? Well, he knew that the AEC and the FBI were investigating, starting in 1965. As the Israel desk officer at the CIA, he talked about the NUMEC case with liaison agent Sam Papich, who was monitoring the investigation for the FBI. He also spoke about it with his colleague John Haddon. On the crime scene particulars, Haddon defended his former boss. Quote, any suggestion that Angleton had helped the Israelis with the NUMEC operation was totally without foundation, he told journalists Andrew and Leslie Coburn. But Haddon didn't deny that Angleton had helped the Israeli nuclear program. Why would somebody whose whole life was dedicated to fighting communism have any interest in preventing a very anti-communist nation from getting the means to defend itself, Haddon asked. The fact they stole it from us didn't worry him in the least, he went on. I suspect that in his inmost heart, he would have given it to them if they had asked. Haddon knew better than to investigate any further. I never sent anything to Angleton on this, the nuclear program, because I knew he wasn't interested, Haddon later told his son, and I knew he'd try to stop it if I did. With the fissile material diverted from NUMEC, Israel was able to construct its first nuclear weapon by 1967 and become a full-blown nuclear power by 1970, the first and still the only nuclear power in the Middle East. Angleton, it is fair to say, thought collaboration with Israel was more important than U.S. non-proliferation policy, and he believed that the results proved his point. When he started as chief of the counterintelligence staff in 1954, the State of Israel and its leaders were regarded warily in Washington, especially at the State Department. When Angleton left government service 20 years later, Israel held twice as much territory as it had in 1948. The CIA and Mossad collaborated on a daily basis, and the governments of the United States and Israel were strategic allies, knit together by expansive intelligence sharing, multi-billion-dollar arms contracts, and coordinated diplomacy. Angleton's influence on U.S.-Israeli relations between 1951 and 1974 exceeded that of any Secretary of State, with the possible exception of Henry Kissinger. His influence was largely unseen by Congress, the press, other democratic institutions, and much of the CIA itself. He was empowered by his own ingenuity and the clandestine arrangements rationalized by doctrines of national security and counterintelligence. The arc of his career breathes life into the concept of the deep state. I thought of this story when I visited one of the memorials to Angleton in Israel in 2016. The memorial is located on a winding road outside the city of Mevaseret Zion, which is now really a suburb of Jerusalem. Historically, control of this high ground has been seen as key to the control of Jerusalem and of Palestine itself, and the nearby ruins of a castle built by 12th century Christian crusaders for exactly that purpose stands in mute testimony to its strategic, the importance of its strategic location. The Angleton Memorial consists of a pedestal of stones topped with a black plaque to James Angleton, a friend, it says. This plaque was dedicated in 1987, a few months after Angleton died, and it has been maintained by his Israeli friends ever since. It's still in perfect condition. The location is no accident. In the course of his extraordinary career, Angleton, more than any other American, enabled the Americans to gain and hold the strategic high ground in the Middle East. He was, as his friend Meyer Amit said, the biggest Zionist of the lot. Thank you.
You have been listening to journalist and author Jefferson Morley speaking in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
Ago, I argued that Foucault assumed the existence of something, namely power, along the lines along which, after 1840, the idea of energy was socially constructed for the physical world, and power being something metaphorically corresponding in the social domain, people considered me evil, David. The recognition that we cannot help but renounce power, not because of a Gandhian or Christian spirit of renunciation to violence, but because the power which we sought 10 or 20 years ago reveals its own void, its own illusory characteristics. I want to suggest the possibility of seeing it as the end of an epoch, just like the Roman Empire, as the time of Augustine, and as an entirely new access, credibility, ease of moving into the world of conspiratio, knowing that it can't be contractually assured, insured. A renunciation to insurance.
You're listening to episode 743 of Unwelcome Guests, Abandoning Wage Slavery and the Illusion of Social Power. I'm Robin Upton. And we've just heard from Ivan Illich. That was from 6 years ago, episode 523, one of the first episodes that I made and one that's pretty close to my heart. We'll get back to Ivan Illich and the collapse of social power in just a minute, but firstly, I'm disappointed this show hasn't gone out as I suggested, on the 15th of October. That was due to various hardware problems, one computer failure and two hard disk corruptions simultaneously. So I don't know quite how that happened, but here we are. I did get the show together. I had backups. Now, next, a personal note. This is the first time I've taken a long holiday from Unwelcome Guests production. It was a spur-of-the-moment decision. I just felt like a break, as it was, to take up the podcast again. But certainly the emails that I received inquiring, was there going to be another show? Am I okay? I appreciate them all. So many thanks for your encouragement on that score. It was very helpful for me to have some time to think about what is Unwelcome Guests. Now, why do I continue to make this show? What is it about that that's important to me? And I came up with a number of new insights in my time for reflection. I hope that I can get some of them across to you in the shows to come. Maybe we're going to have a little bit of a change of emphasis. It's no secret that I've done a lot of research into the deep state. I've pulled those threads and tried to find out hidden levers of power, how that machine actually operates. And I've done my best to document that on WikiSpooks. I've also taken the time away from Unwelcome Guests to improve the programming, the presentation of that information. So you may find that worth a visit. You may continue, if you're looking for more deep state material, to check out wikispooks.com. You could also even become a member. You can edit the material yourself. It's all open source, open access. Now, if you're a deep state watcher, you may find it helpful to join up with other people with similar interests, and you may find it also useful to contribute what you have to share. I think we will be still having a few shows on the deep state where that becomes important. I think, broadly speaking, if you're a regular Unwelcome Guests listener, you're probably pretty clued up about the deep state, about how the corporate media serve them by dishing out fake narratives to deliberately misinform people, not just slightly wrong, but where possible, they try and invert 180 degrees so that victim becomes victimizer and vice versa, that being a good way of hiding what's really going on. So it's kind of a conspiratorial view of history. I make no apology for that. A lot of people used to be very clear in the US that conspiracies by small numbers of usually men were going on all the time. And only in recent decades, particularly since the CIA memo countering criticism of the Warren Commission report, have a lot of conscious efforts been made to try to stop people reflecting on the possibility that forces might be conspiring against them and their interests. So I'm very glad we focused on the deep state for some time and established certain understandings about what's really going on. But that having been said, in the future, we're going to be having a wider range of topics on the show. When I first came across this show, I think it was about 2003, that was one of the points that really attracted me, the wide range of material and the way that Lynn Gehry managed to tie it all together. Now, at that time, fresh from a PhD in university, I was very ill-informed on the way the world really works. I had a lot of inherited myths which I hadn't actually thought about, and Lynn Gehry's Unwelcome Guests really hit the spot for me. That's what I'm trying to do for another generation of listeners, and that's one of the main reasons why I'm continuing to make this show. Now, I'm still impressed by Lynn Gehry's efforts at turning out weekly shows for 10 years, 500 shows in all. I don't know if I can expect to follow that. On reflection, and with Lynn's canon of shows still available to provide education on a broad range of topics, I'm looking at producing more thoughtful shows, spending longer on each episode, so maybe once a month. That's not to say necessarily that the show will only be coming out once a month, because I'm in touch with a couple of unwelcome guests, listeners, who have expressed interest in producing their own episodes of Unwelcome Guests. Now, whilst you've come up with a lot of interesting material in the past, aside from the material, I've missed out on your reflections. So, as another alternative to producing an entire show, a midpoint between just selecting material and making a two-hour episode, if you want to make a segment of the show, then that could be very helpful and could be included in a larger episode. And it might help me transition from full-time producer of this show to being part-time producer and part-time editor. You know, I live in Bangladesh and I don't meet many people face-to-face with whom I can share these sorts of ideas. And lacking that kind of impetus, I do sometimes wish that I had more of a collective, a team with which to work on the internet. So if that sounds attractive to you, the first step is to join the mailing list where we can discuss plans for moving forward in a slightly different direction in the future. So my expectation of that is that it will be informed by all the study we've done of the deep state, but probably not having that as the main topic. This is partly a case of diminishing returns. I think we've done enough on the deep state over the last couple of years. And partly, I want something positive. I want something, when all said and done, these deep state leaders are actually only a small number of people, very, very small group, who, under the current setup, manage to amplify their decision-making capabilities and have these various ideologies and these technologies set up to, I think, trick a lot of people into carrying out wishes of the minority, the 0.0001%, say, whilst almost everybody else in the world would like these things not to happen. And that brings us back to the topic of this show, wage slavery. I think it's a great phrase. I think if people came up with it nowadays, the corporate media wouldn't go near it with a barge pole because it's much too revealing. It sheds light on a reality that the global capitalist class would love to keep hidden. That is, that people can live lives like slaves, even if they are in fact earning a wage. We don't explicitly say in law, you must do what you're told to do and you'll be liable to punishment if you don't do it. So you're not a slave in that sense. You're a slave because you have an appetite and you need to feed yourself. And you're in an environment where food is not freely available. Food is delivered by those who will be expecting money in return. And money can be produced out of thin air, but not by you. By the global financial wizards, as Smithy pointed out. So if you'd like to know more on that, you can look back at the Wizards of Money series. Just type that into your favourite search engine. So it's very definitely not a natural condition of Homo sapiens, but it does correspond to a lot of people's daily realities that they feel, well, I need money to live, especially adults living in cities in most parts of the world. This is their daily experience and has been the experience of their parents, their grandparents, perhaps going back hundreds of years, the feeling that you must earn money in order to live. That's buttressed, of course, by a lot of ideology. And we have phrases such as cost of living, which have become part of the language, and so on. Now, where the wealth inequality is the most extreme, the ideology needs to be that much more extreme to maintain the difference, to help people to function with equanimity and not to stop and question what's going on. My mind is drawn somehow to the 5% of the world's population in the US who consume 25% or so of the world's resources. And that's not to look at them as a homogeneous group. There's huge wealth imbalance inside the US, that is just a reflection of the same ideology, not an ideology based upon the physical attributes of the human being, which are more or less equal. That's an ideology based upon this virtual quantity, which is referred to as money, which can get as unequal as humans will let it. And until human beings can break that connection, this person has a large amount, this person has none in the resource world, this must entail a justifiable imbalance in the distribution. Till we break that link, then we're likely to face continued struggle from the majority of the population, and under the current system, it's getting a larger and larger majority who are effectively dispossessed. The increasing ranks of the global precariat, who are allowed to struggle for access only to the minimum resources required to keep them serviceable for the money masters. As an indication of the growing proportion of the US population who belong to the global precariat, a survey of 5,000 Americans discovered that 62% of them had less than $1,000 in savings. Now, that was last year, and this year 69% have less than $1,000 in savings. So this gives us another lens through which to look at the increasing militarization of the policing in the US. If respect and rights are afforded to people in proportion to economic matters, rather than saying you're a law-abiding member of the community, you deserve respect, is your share of the available land, you'd like some help with the house or some medical bills, you don't want you getting sick or being unhoused, so there you go. If it comes down to money, as with ever-increasing privatization, it's likely to do, that is the explicit aim of the people who would privatize everything. They say, well, when we approach things as a business, they get done more efficiently. And if we reduce these functions of government to financial matters only, then it looks like an ever-increasing proportion of the US population are likely to be treated as a means to an end rather than as any kind of end in themselves. I think from that perspective, Ivan Illich's bold prediction about a sudden collapse of social power is perhaps not so surprising. Suggestion just being that if things keep going in this direction, an ever sharpening of the disparity in wealth, less and less need for labour, more and more resources being spent not on actual productive activity, but on maintaining the inequality, ideological and technological resources. I think it was John Taylor Gatto years ago who pointed out that the most common profession in the US was security guard. I haven't got the statistics at hand, but he was onto something. He could see the direction that the society was going in. Now, Ivan Illich, of course, doesn't in that quote talk about money at all. He talks about social power, which I find quite interesting. And my understanding is that his insights, and this is a man who thought a lot of this out for himself in the 1970s, Illich had a sort of pan-institutional analysis, and he certainly wrote a lot of inspiring books, as far as I'm concerned. He could see that it doesn't make sense to only talk about the money system. In the money system, yeah, it's a fiction. So how does it manage to capture people's imagination? Well, it wouldn't work if it didn't have backing from the legal system, if it didn't have the educational system to tell people exactly what they don't need to know about money and skip the essential points about where it comes from. And similarly, you know, the politicians nominally responsive to what people want, why do they go along with creating and perpetuating this system of slavery for the masses? Because they're being manipulated. I mean, directly is in terms of bribes, it's easy to see, but ideologically, if they choose left or right, if we see politics as a one-dimensional spectrum, we're allowing our own imaginations, our ideas, to be channeled down paths. I mean, polar opposites. How best to get people to oppose other people than to say you two hold opposite positions. It's a divide and conquer mechanism, but Illich avoids explicit discussion about money in that quote because it's a larger problem than that. If we go back into feudal times, money wasn't much of an issue for hardly anybody. I mean, it was used for international type trades, it was used for arms deals and various sort of kings plundering each other's treasury. But from an everyday perspective, if you're a farmer, then you didn't sell your food, you grew it and you gave it to the Lord who will protect you, and it was divinely ordained. And they had a whole system that didn't need money, and because he was the Lord and he was the son of the earlier Lord, and you knew that that was how it was going to work. And some of this is lost on us because we seem to assume that the past worked the way the present worked. Money was everywhere. Well, there was money, but issues such as who was the lord of the manor, or dukes, earls, and the point is that the system of sort of class hierarchy in the UK hasn't actually been abolished. It's just been eclipsed as the money system took over, as redefining the relationships and deciding what was and what wasn't possible. And I think in the future, that's a possibility that we need to think about, that the money system will keep going, but will be eclipsed by alternative ways of organizing. And this episode is not called Abolishing the Money System. I don't anticipate that the powers that be, from their perspective, they don't see a problem with the money system. And a lot of problems, such as the fact that it's not serving most of humanity or most of life, they would like to solve with violence and say, well, we have the army under our control, we're paying these guys handsomely, they're going to keep following our bidding. Or perhaps they're even planning further ahead and saying, well, we're going to control the whole lot of you with drones and automated technology which we physically possess. Well, if they try that approach, I think they're going to find the technology is not as reliable as they rather hoped. But it's called abandoning the money system because I think it's going to be a grassroots approach, not even necessarily a sort of altruistic exercise by people determined to serve the greater good. And that's an inspiring thought for me. It might just be a fact that more and more people decide, increasingly, I'm finding it very difficult to keep going in the money system. Quite practically, I'm not getting good food, I'm not getting good housing, it's not working for me. And if people can overcome the divide and conquer programming and team up, then potentially large numbers of people could abandon the money system. They can make alternative arrangements for living on this earth. As an illustration of just what you lose in terms of appreciating life on earth if money becomes such a major factor, I often cite the case of people asking, can we afford to save the environment? Would it cost us too much? And it shows, to my mind, just how people's thoughts are trapped. And that is going to come up again in this episode. People, because of their life experience and because that's buttressed by an ideology, a lot of systems of thought all pointing in the one direction that we've got to keep this system running. And because of that, people, in spite of their best efforts to try and think clearly about other things we could do, end up mimicking this existing system. My best illustration of that, so we're not going to come back to this, but as a side comment, is Bitcoin. Bitcoin, effective technology in the sense of it's a globally accountable register that is going to be difficult for people to forge. A lot of people have been trying and haven't had great success. And yet, why do people enjoy it? Why do people use it? Because it works like money, and therefore it's scarce. And therefore, if you've got a lot of money in the existing system, you can step into the world of Bitcoin. Certainly, sir, how much would you like? So although it's an advance, it's a step in the right direction, it maintains certain key problems of scarcity. I mean, also the problem of abstraction. It's a numerical calculation. It's not about the real world. And that, I think, is, in one sense, the beginning and the end of what this episode is about. That in order to escape wage slavery, in one sense, we as a group don't have to do anything much more complicated than just consider the natural world. Return to the way of looking at the world that a child has, where a bank statement, a bank note, a passport, a gold certificate, at the end of the day, is just a piece of paper that at some stage is going to get put into the soil and is going to rot. Therefore, if we want to really understand the world, we can't let that exercise such a control over our imaginations. And we're going to be coming back to this idea of looking at reality as it really is. And if we had an ability to do that, if we weren't looking through economically tinted spectacles, would people be quite so likely to cut corners with their safety precautions on nuclear power plants? Would we even have nuclear power plants if we were considering 7 generations ahead? And this is not a radically new idea, far from it. This is a Garden of Eden type idea before we had these institutions. We had the real world, and the real world is going to outlive these institutions. With or without human beings, these ideas that people have about nationalism, patriotism, fascism, these ideas about land ownership, interest-bearing debt, derivatives, currency speculation, well, these are human ideas, but they don't have a meaning in the real world, have a meaning in our minds, so much of which are carefully polluted, carefully channeled by the banksters, the money masters, the deep politicians, a very small number of people who sit atop large social hierarchies. And this deception works. Party politics says we've got to have a system of electoral politics that's reminiscent of the past. So you need a representative, and you're going to have to pick somebody from the list. Of course, it's a free system. You're able to get yourself represented. You put yourself on the list, pay some money to do that, of course. And as long as people find that they're choosing from a list, then they're not really free to choose. Because if push comes to shove, and it has done occasionally, people do get their names rubbed off of that list in a multitude of different ways. First one that springs to my mind is the Australian coup. I think it was 1976. Gough Whitlam was slightly too independent-minded, talking about, do we need a CIA base in Australia? And his license to run the country was summarily revoked. The Australian constitutional crisis. Wikipedia dresses it up as something else. That's party politics. In law, we've seen this. There's one law for the rich and one for the poor. So we have this judicial discretion sentencing and various ways to decide not to prosecute. So that's the legal system. Certain people can be decided too big to jail. Don't think we're going to move on that one. The wage slaves, doesn't matter about their good intentions. They never get to move on that case. Economics is too big to fail. So we can't have that bank going down. Let's transfuse some cash. We haven't got the licenses. Okay, quick, let's get the licenses. Get some politicians to sign off on this. You as an individual, well, you're free to play the money game. And within these laws that have been ready set down, you're free to do what you like. That's real freedom. Except it isn't real freedom because you're being harvested. If you're using money, you're paying a ground rent on their system because all that money is issued at interest. So even if you think, well, I'm not paying the ground rent on it, then you're supporting the system by proxy. Now, that might be, for example, if you're a law-abiding citizen, you're paying your taxes. Well, then the government is paying the ground rent for you. Because where does a large slice of that tax money go? Straight back to the banksters. Oh, that's the national debt. Do governments have to have national debts? No, certainly they don't. I think there's one or two that don't. They're in the process of being rolled up by the global homogenization process, which wants to destroy all oppositional models to encourage people. Of course, this is how things are. This is the only way things can be. One thing you're not allowed to do is to counterfeit money. It's their monopoly, and you're taking on a big machine if you're trying to step outside that role. No, your role is to move these chips around and be glad if you end up with enough food on your plate at the end of the day. So this is a repeated story in multiple different domains. There is an illusion of freedom. People are given a choice, but it's like the choice of the student captain. You maybe get to choose what music is playing when you wander into the prom, where you choose what colour posters are going to be put on the wall. Should we have Coke or Pepsi for the after-school party? It's a fictional choice. Real decisions, the decisions that matter, being taken elsewhere. These are decisions that frame goings-on so that abundance is suppressed wherever possible and scarcity maintains the illusion that competition is necessary. And like the Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland, the names of these places where these decisions are really taken, together with the identities of the people who make these decisions, firmly off the news agenda, so you're probably not even aware of what is going on. Now, Illich doesn't emphasize this, but I will. There is a story about there being powerful people up there, big guys, who you don't want to mess with because these guys have power. And as long as enough people believe that, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I find it much more wholesome to try to understand and grasp the arguments put forward by Illich about the vacuousness of social power. I talk a lot about money. I say that's my particular focus. But legal power in Bangladesh, there's a very well understood difference between the law as it is written and the law as it is in practice. And I think this stems from colonialization, from a time basically when they didn't have much in the way of functional law. Suddenly, white overlords appear with guns who need to be satisfied that this country is going to run according to how they see that it should run. And their motives are not entirely sort of mercenary. They do, a lot of them no doubt believe that they're instilling law and order for the good of the natives, and therefore go out about and set a system of high courts and officials and governors, put that structure in place, but perhaps attributing sort of fetishistic properties to this structure of rules and regulations, where the bottom line is that if it's a foreign concept to the majority of the people, then barring super enforcement technologies, there's always going to be a lot of difficulty getting people to follow it. So we have a nominal system of rules which applies somewhat inside of the city, local control, and then the rest of Bangladesh. These rules aren't particularly important unless they happen to catch the public imagination. I'm simplifying quite a lot, actually. But I don't think that that is such a different phenomenon. I don't think it's especially Bangladesh. David Graeber talked about how things outside of the capital, that was Madagascar, I think. I think this is a fairly widespread phenomenon and an important one, one that is largely obscured to Western eyes. Where there are alternate, contrasting value systems, whether they're religious, cultural, whether they're in the language, then it's understood the sort of modern business techno project is one way to see the world, not the only way. If you've grown up in New York, you may think, well, yes, of course, this is how the world works because this is how they've decided it, and that's one particular office, and now everybody knows it, and there are rules, and everybody's going to follow the rules. Whereas for the majority of the world, things are not that simple. These powers of the powers that be are not so cut and dried. And the reality is that if the food supply runs short, or electricity runs short in a colder country. And it doesn't have to be a disaster, of course, to provoke a change in behavior, perhaps because somebody puts some audio out there or a video, posts it on YouTube, enough people watch it and say, that's a good idea, I think we'll do that instead. So a lot of these systems, which would love to say that they're going to be here for good, may not be here on a permanent basis. What we can count on is a continued need for people to provide for their stomachs. Now, since the current system has been set up with centralization in mind, so to pick one important example, power generation, massive subsidies for nuclear power, these large, potentially disastrous things, which never actually were very efficient economically, if you look at the environmental costs, when you factor that in, but yeah, minimal attention to things like solar power, wind power, decentralized power, which potentially, as far as serving people's needs, it's power exactly where you want it, wherever you happen to be, you can take it with you. So very helpful as far as people are concerned, therefore not helpful as far as centralization. Much better to have a single point of generation, tie everybody to the city through this with wires. You've got something you can turn off. We're in that situation where the technology is now supporting the law, the economics, the politics, they're all working together in one ruthless hierarchical system. So the current systems that we have, food generation, delivery of people's basic survival, is not actually in the hands of the individuals because it wasn't designed that way. Now, as long as the system keeps running, then push doesn't come to shove. This might seem, well, this is a more efficient way of doing things, but it strikes me to be totally unnatural to have, I'm making this show on the 23rd story of a concrete building miles away from any food that I know is growing in a city of 25 million people. So if you think that is going to be in any sense, shape or form a natural arrangement, then we've got different expectations about how life could and should be. I'm going to say the word should because it's a very unnatural experience and it doesn't feel as grounded as, say, the hypothetical Bangladesh village. I keep picking Bangladesh village because I go to a lot of Bangladesh villages. But, I mean, even a situation, if I were able to grow food here and if I were able to converse with the neighbours, it's not necessarily only the physical living arrangements.
They're the first things that spring to mind because they're easiest to see. But there's the psychology, the social arrangements, and the city is not an area of community. It's not an independent source of power. It's centralized. If you're living in the city, then you're subject to the city's rules. And that's exactly why China, for example, is still building these massive, massive tower blocks. I think at last count, they had about 60 million of these apartments ready for rent with people not buying them, but they're still building them because it fits that control paradigm. Looked at from one perspective, well, this is lunacy. Looked at from an economic perspective, this is common sense. The fact that poor people might be getting increasingly angry, might be getting increasingly hungry and homeless, doesn't factor. They don't have what economists refer to as effective demand. To put it another way, this is all about providing for the few who are in charge of the system. Well, given their assumption of self-interest, we can't be too surprised. But from the top of these large systems, the perspective is quite different than from underneath. For the canonical example of that, consider the impact of Homo sapiens from a non-human perspective. If we were only slightly better at doing that, I think human beings wouldn't be quite so heartily engaged in the ecocide, which is still going on. But to summarise, when we run according to money, if people are wage slaves, then they're not using their human capacities of empathy. They are working less than human with, for the most part, predictably unhealthy results. So, the systems of the Techno-Control Project, not only are they not designed to work harmoniously with the natural world, they're not designed to work harmoniously with Homo sapiens, and are actually very inefficient at delivering these. For example, they're sending food enormous distances through lots of high technology. Very ill-advised if we think about a potential peak oil situation, if we're looking at disruptions, unprecedented. And that's one of the things we see from this sort of hyper-efficient organization of business. The way to get the maximum profit is not necessarily the way to build a resilient system, not necessarily a way to build a system that does anything that people want. So the danger of organizing society as if it's one large business-making machine is not visible from the top of the machine, from the apex of the organizations. Then one is very distanced from the grassroots, the discontent, and the acts of God, the disruptions, which would appear to be, as Charles Eisenstein predicts in his Ascent of Humanity, increasingly manifesting and proving tricky for the great technological project of control. So I'm back to the point that Illich made, that seeking power in the society is a vacuous concept. Compare that with, for example, seeking to provide healthy food for oneself and one's family and one's neighbours, seeking to be on good terms with the people around one, seeking to understand the local environment, trying to make it less polluted, make it more fruitful, make it full of more harmony. These are nonsense words to the economic system, and yet they speak to my heart. I speak to the hearts of many people. In the wage slavery system, then this is just so much distraction from the bottom line, which can be calculated, optimized. We've seen a lot of where that system is going, and a lot of speakers on the show have been talking about that. So my focus here is, what is this psychological process that's necessary for people to anticipate the changes, for people as a group to step forward into the new world? Now, certainly communication and exchange of ideas is going to be a big part of that. Welcome to the internet. We have the technology for that. I think it was last week that the UK police charged a man with terrorism. One of his crimes was use of encryption. Now, that didn't used to be a crime, but apparently, according to the 2006 Prevention of Terrorism Act, it can be a crime if it's used for terrorist purposes. So that hangs a lot of legal weight upon who defines what a terrorist is. And perhaps you wouldn't be surprised to know, if you've been following this show, of course you'll know that terrorism is not something that governments can do. It's something that's done by non-state actors, and that's one of the first parts of the definition. I think this was probably worked out in Jerusalem in 1979 or thereabouts, when deep state actors arranged, how are we going to get round charges of people applying these laws to governments? So it's perceived as a potential threat, this free exchange of ideas. But whilst we've got it, let's use it. So let me ask you personally, have you had enough of wage slavery? Where do you sit on this great debate? Do we need to have money? Do we need to have employees? Could we live healthier and happier lives than we do now without this type of contractual arrangement and without the social hierarchies that go with it? Have we had enough of this? I personally feel like I never want to be a wage slave again. I haven't been a wage slave for very long compared to a lot of people, and I can't imagine what it would be like to spend one's whole life as a wage slave. But then I can't imagine what it would have been like to have been a literal slave, shackled somewhere with a grim future prospect ahead, and probably a head full of ideas about how my kind of creature was unworthy to do the decision-making and somehow divinely ordained to be following orders. Humanity was in that situation, and a combination of the slaves themselves and other people who could see that and empathize with that thought, let's not have this. Let's make a world without this. Have we got what it takes? This generation, can we say, we've had enough of wage slavery. We can see what it's doing to people, both the wage slaves and the oppressors, and what it's doing to the world. And we don't want this. Let's put an end to wage slavery before it puts an end to us. Another example of technology bringing abundance. But look at copyright. It's more or less possible to get not everything, but not far off. There's a lot of material out there digitally, which is accessible despite a lot of efforts by various copyright holders. Can we say, yeah, copyright worked in the past and did certain things. Now we're going to abandon it. We're going to say information is just noughts and ones. Nobody pays for noughts and ones. Welcome to the world of digital and cultural abundance, anybody who has access to a computer. Did we do that? If you've had a legal school training in copyright law, you probably think, well, no, that can't work for X and Y and Z reason. And slavery, remember, literal slavery, was God's ordained plan. It talks about slaves in the Bible. It says, obey your masters. Just as we had the divine right of kings, just as we had the manifest destiny, why else were these natives dropping dead of various diseases? Obviously, it's a sign that the white man should take over their land. And these are doctrines which we've had in the past, which we've gone beyond. Why should anybody be in a position where they feel, I really don't want to do this, but I'm not going to get fed if I don't? In a world which throws away half the food that gets produced, how is that morally different from putting a gun to somebody's head and saying, you're going to keep working, otherwise I'm going to pull the trigger? Well, the main difference that I can see is, if there's one human being with a gun, that's a person who's identifiable, who has a conscious will to enforce that slavery, whereas the system we have now is effective at disguising the responsibility. This was written about very eloquently by Steinbeck in Grapes of Wrath, the way that economic forces force people off the land, and there wasn't an identifiable agent of ill will. It was a team effort. It was a systemic process. Well, would you be willing to hold a gun to somebody's head like that just for your own profit to force suffering on other people? Well, are you willing to pay taxes to a government which does the same thing, as national governments in the West are doing en masse? They're using the money system, they're using the legal system, they're using various nominally free and independent systems which they have all set up, there's no accident there, and they're using all these systems to exploit the poor of the world and extract whatever value they can get away with. The countries so-called poor tend to be lacking in armaments. They can't fight back. This is a bully system on an international scale, but it operates under cover of these various ideologies that says, well, if you don't work, you shan't eat. And these are poor countries, and we're developed and educated, so they need our help to develop their economies, and so on and so on, yada, yada, yada. It has an intellectual cover. When it was going on in the 1960s and 70s, this mass exportation of the development model, building of schools and hospitals, Ivan Illich called this project a war on subsistence, said this is not in aggregate going to improve people's well-being, but exactly the reverse. He annoyed a lot of people. 50 years later, I think a lot more people are in a position to understand what he was talking about. Are we mature enough to be honest with ourselves and say, yes, I have heard those stories, and yes, I'm being paid to believe this. My heart tells me different, and that is all I need to know. Can we do that? Well, obviously, I think there is a possibility, or I wouldn't be making this appeal. But more than that, I am really convinced that this older way of doing things has met its match. If I'm hungry and cold, then obtaining sufficient food and warmth is going to be very high on my list of priorities. But once I have some material comfort, quite quickly, it's going to become very important to me that I'm behaving in a way that is proper, in a way that I am content with. And how I treat other people is going to be very high on the list. Anybody who clings to, well, this is the system as we have it, this is what I'm sticking to, are, in the words of the great late Martin Luther King, on the wrong side of history. If we can say, as a species, we have done things differently in the past, we resolve to do things in a way that seems more harmonious, then let's do it. Some of the paralysis, some of why this hasn't happened yet, has been the failure to find a common voice. The different languages, the different contexts, the different local problems, I suggest we now see each other, we now see ourselves increasingly as one species occupying one planet. Previously, we've been stymied by our failure to articulate clearly enough what it is that people want. People were too parochial and too small-minded in what they aimed for. We demanded a good standard of living for Americans or Christians, never mind the infidels. We'd split the world up into us and them. We sought to turn it only to the convenience of Homo sapiens and thought that we could dispense with as many other life forms as we felt like. I think more and more people would agree we need, as far as we can manage it, to embrace the diversity, never mind of all people, but of all species on this planet. Even as they're delivering wage slavery, the globalists embrace the language of freedom because they know that it appeals to people, it speaks to their hearts. Why then do people continue to get tricked, end up working for money, not for love? What gives me hope that this can change? One thing that I've seen in my lifetime, which has come, which I think is an essential part of the mix, is this ability, the internet, basically to communicate in real time about subjects. We've got software to change languages. That's not a barrier. And this communication is a baseline for a shared understanding. It doesn't necessarily follow, but I think that is the way that the world is going, and I think that is a reflection that we don't want a world full of other people who are scary, who are threatening, and who have other laws. That has been people's evolution in the past. Small bands of 150 or so people think like primates, and most of the world potentially quite scary and threatening. Can we beat our swords into plowshares? Have we had enough of weapons and war? We've a lot of issues, a lot of sides to this. We've looked at the importance of death, the importance of understanding. That was episode 726, why it has been in the past, these blood rituals, these sacrifices of the other people. I'm mixing in lots of topics here, but we've looked at so many different angles of this. And I think it's all summed up in this question, have we got the maturity, whether that's sort of intellectual, social, emotional, spiritual, are we ready for a world in which we say wage slavery is not something that I want to be a part of? Applying the golden rule means even being a slave master is not acceptable to me. I'm not going to be part of a system where other people are compelled through needless scarcity to follow my orders. I think that is what Illich is talking about when he talks about the vacuousness of power. So I don't talk about power. I say, if I need to write this up on WikiSpooks, I'll say these are people who occupy senior positions in the hierarchy. Potentially, I could say these are influential people because of their social positions, but not calling these people powerful, because we always have a choice. Till they invent a brain chip, which effectively puts you under somebody else's literal control, then any control that they feel they exercise over us is purely in our minds. Now I think it's time for me to play the media that I found. I heard this a couple of weeks ago, and I thought that's a good point to bring out, because I talk in largely conditional terms, a subjunctive mood, about the end of this social power, but I don't perhaps highlight often enough that, like, say, the toppling of a dictatorship or the collapse of a large structure subject to a lot of damage, although the end of this may be quite sudden and take only a short time, every piece of damage that's done to the structure, every time somebody stands up to oppression, well, that all adds up somewhere along the line. And people are ongoing in their efforts to free themselves and free others from wage slavery. The process is underway and assisted by developments in technology, bringing abundance and putting like minds in touch. I'm going to play you an adaptation of a video that I found about another straw on the camel's back. Now, this is a project that's liberated only a relatively small number of people from actual wage slavery, and only a year at a time, but it's done so within the current money system, and it's done so by a larger number of people contributing money. So the people who set this project up are giving people a basic income, and they're very clearly saying, well, this is not a raffle, this is not a lottery, you can put some money in and maybe you'll get some money out. They're very clear to not establish that connection. This is a gift that you may wish to give, and if you wish to, we will take some money, we will give it as a basic income to people, and we're going to be completely open about the accounts. It's an experiment by people whose vision of the future is a vision of abundance, not a vision of scarcity. Their vision of human nature primarily is of people who like to help other people, not people who are ruthless, not the psychopaths whose economic model is the one that I was taught at university, and they're still determined to try to force that as human nature. My heart tells me different, as does this video, a sign of the changes which I think are coming. And this was produced in June 2015 as a video. It's been seen by 50,000 people on YouTube, and thanks to the Unwelcome Guests Collective for contributing voices. It's entitled Money for Free by VPRO Backlight, and I will link to the original video from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/743.
At this moment, in various places around the world, experiments with handing out money for free are ongoing. You get it for free from people who feel it's time to break the current relationship between work and income. New ways must be found to share the world's wealth, simply because in future there won't be enough jobs to go around.
So we say, remove the link. Your income is guaranteed.
And on the other hand, you will see that arbeid, welke vorm.
And you'll see at the other end that all types of labor, paid or unpaid, will be much more equal and get much more attention.
I don't think we need to wait for somebody in Washington, D.C. to decide that this is something that needs to happen, or Berlin, or wherever the seat of your respective government may be. I think these are things we can start to work on just as we are today.
We urgently need to find new ways to combat the growing inequality between rich and poor and to redistribute the wealth. So we decided to look for people who do experiments in pursuit of new solutions to major social problems. These people are like a new species, They can't be labelled as academics, journalists, politicians, or activists. They are all of these at once. They don't wait for approval, but simply go ahead with small-scale experiments. A young startup entrepreneur from Berlin decided to change his life. He stopped working for his own internet company and now receives €1,000 a month from its profits. He regards this sum as his basic income.
And this is Michael Bohmeier, founder of Mein Grundeinkommen.
I've never noticed how much pressure I was under until it was gone. I never noticed it until the pressure was gone. I was never a creative person. I wasn't a gifted speaker. But suddenly I can do those things. I have so many ideas that I can barely get them down on paper. I've truly become a new man. It's crazy. I feel so relieved and my health has improved a lot too. And then I thought, it would be the same for anyone. We should try this. So we need money to give to people for 1 year unconditionally. I have no money myself, so we'll do it through crowdfunding.
Michael is starting up a crowdfunding project, and he calls it My Basic Income. The project aims to generate money to give people a basic income for 1 year.
People go meingrundeinkommen.de and they can donate money through various payment options as much as they want. And they can join the sweepstake and register for the next raffle. It's two independent things. That's important. It's not a lottery. It's a raffle. You don't have to pay the first to join in. It's unconditional, and that's important. We pool all the money and wait until it amounts to €12,000. That's a 1 year basic income, €1,000 a month. And then we draw a winner. 18,800 people registered online and were given a virtual raffle ticket. You can check it all on our website.
And there's a large Wheel of Fortune in the studio.
Give it a bit spin. This is an exciting phase. In 2014, we raffled five basic incomes of €1,000 a month for five lucky winners. Now we have a new, bigger goal. We want to finance 100 basic incomes by using two things. First, this is a loyalty card. You show it as you pay for things in shops. That way you accumulate points or credit, which is worth some money. Everyone has the same card and the credit flows into one bank account. This gives us €50 a day towards the basic income. It doesn't cost the card users anything, and it's completely anonymous. Second, we have an internet version for web shops. They have a button. You click it, and a commission of the sale goes into this basic income kitty. It's like a tiny consumer tax. In the future, we could probably use it to finance a basic income. We already do this on a small scale, 1 to 5% per transaction. We got more than €20,000 in the last 3 months.
Und so kamen in den letzten drei Monaten schon über 20.000 Euro zusammen.
But who pays for that in the end?
Naja, es zahlen die Unternehmen.
Well, the shops pay for it. For them, it's advertising, so to speak, to encourage customers into the shop. But I think the customers always buy there anyway, and this is a chance for them to do something worthwhile as they do.
This is a completely unconditional basic income for anyone. There are no rules about age or country. Even children can register. The fifth basic income was put up for raffle, and it went to 8-year-old Robin from Baden-Württemberg. After a marathon debate lasting 2 days, his parents decided to tell him.
I'm rich. We're using it to go on holiday and to pay the rent, and we get a new book once a month.
We talk about basic income, but not money itself. We want to grant ourselves a little bit of freedom and ask ourselves what will happen if we feel more free and relaxed. Worrying about money never got me anywhere. When I could let go, I felt much better. We don't save it, we live off it. I thought, why not? If I can do okay for 1 year, that's a damn good thing. And we see Michel Baumeier walking into a warehouse of soft drinks, and there's a pile of cases marked Mittercola, Generation Grundeinkommen, Basic Income Generation, and he holds up a bottle of cola with the slogan, what would you work at if you already had a basic income?
I know there's a lot of material and research, but other people are better at that than I just want to tell the story and make it come alive. No dull political debate about how great it would be. I want people to click now, donate now, and get a basic income next month. We need to change society so everyone can be comfortable. That requires security and unconditional love. It's what babies need when they want to be held. We can't hold all the adults, but 1,000 euros a month is a start to relieve the pressure so people can believe in themselves again. I'm a father myself, and I see a lot of parallels with having children. Children are most cooperative and thrive the best when they feel safe.
Kinder sind dann besonders
close to their parents and when they are free to cry if they fail. All the things we as adults are no longer allowed to do.
In der Nähe sind und wenn sie zum Beispiel auch mal weinen können, wenn sie auch mal scheitern können, all das, was wir Erwachsenen gar nicht mehr dürfen.
Michael's project My Basic Income now provides 8 people with a basic income. But what would happen if you gave an entire community a basic income? Guy Standing is an economist and a strong advocate of basic income. He's involved in several experiments in developing countries and has recently finalised one in India.
For 30 years or more, I don't want to reveal the full extent of these dreams, I've always been advocating and supporting moving towards a basic income. And it's very, very rare that any of us ever have the opportunity to put a dream into potential reality.
6,000 people in India were given a guaranteed basic income for a period of 18 months, unconditionally, individually, and paid in cash.
The men get 200 rupees, the women get 200 rupees. The children's money goes into the mother's bank account. You will receive 200 rupees a month, unconditionally. You are free to decide how to use it.
The striking thing that we found was improved nutrition and improved health. The level of economic activity increased in all the villages. The level of earned income, that's apart from the basic income, increased significantly more in these villages. We did not provide any skills training. We did not provide any guidance because we wanted to see what happens when you're doing a basic income.
I think the only way to make progress is that through pilots on a small scale, that if they're successful, they can be built up. We desperately need to find ways of redistributing income because the degree of inequality, whether it's in the Netherlands or it's Britain or in India, I mean, has become obscene. All the old forms of redistribution, income tax, social security, don't work in a globalized, open economic system.
Literally millions of Europeans are living on the edge of unsustainable debt. They're living on the edge of not knowing whether that tomorrow morning or the next day they're going to have the means to pay for their absolute essentials. And we've got a situation where that insecurity is corrosive on our mental health, on our relationships, our capacity to function. And we're creating a society with the precariat growing, which is becoming dangerous in the sense that it's that the simmering disquiet and simmering social illnesses that are building up. And it's got to the point now where I think that unless we have reforms towards a more universalistic approach, a rights-based approach, away from means testing, away from behavior testing, away from all these assessment forms that poor many people have to fill in. Unless we can say, ooh, let's wake up and move to a better direction, then we're going to build up a society where to talk of social solidarity, it will become a bad joke.
Guy Standing travels all over the world to share his experiences and to find partners who are willing to experiment further at local level. He's been invited to speak in Groningen in order to help develop an experiment with people on welfare. Joop Roebroek and Jan-Willem Vennekes are members of MIEST, the Community for the Innovation of Economics and Society. It's a group of interested entrepreneurs and scientists from Groningen. They are keen to actually start an experiment in one specific neighborhood of the city of Groningen.
Hello.
Hi.
Mr. Nice Standing, welcome
nice
to Netherlands.
Guy.
No. Welcome
nice
to Netherlands.
Hi, guy.
Nice
what's your name?
Joop.
Joop?
Yeah, Jan-Willem.
Jan-Willem, nice
then
to meet you.
Take one.
Okay.
So you
it's
have to...
cold.
Yes. Typical Dutch weather.
Yeah, very Dutch.
Okay. Waiting.
And yesterday was a very busy day for me. So you're both from Groningen, right?
Yeah, well, I studied there.
Oh, okay.
And I lived there since 1 year.
If I understand it rightly, it's a sort of strong socialist area or
yes. Yeah,
left.
It is, yeah, area. It has a strong socialist background. The Dutch welfare state was actually one of the most developed welfare states. But the last 20 years, it's really developing into a...
Workfare state.
Yes. Yeah. The time that you get an unemployment benefit is becoming shorter and shorter. Means tests everywhere appear in the system. And it's a much more disciplinary system. It became really a disciplinary system.
Setting up a social experiment in the Western world is a complicated matter. The challenge lies in the fact that we have a complex social security system in place. This needs to be dismantled before we can set up a new one.
Joop Roebroek.
De overheid zit gewoon helemaal vast.
The authorities are stuck. We don't think there will be any movement there. If you use our head, there are opportunities for experimenting to find valid solutions, and we are starting that up.
Echt wel valide, zeg maar, oplossingen bieden, en dat gaan we gewoon doen.
Jan-Willem Vennekes.
Wat we bedacht hebben is om kleinschalige experimenten te doen in bijvoorbeeld steden.
We're planning small-scale experiments in villages or city districts with unconditional assistance.
Onvoorwaardelijke bijstand bijvoorbeeld.
For people already on welfare or entitled to welfare but that couldn't face applying for it.
Maar die hem nu niet aanvragen vanwege alle regeltjes.
If you can exempt these people from all the obligations, it may have an interesting effect.
Dwang, zeg maar, en dan zou je ook interessante effecten kunnen gaan meten.
A meeting of experts is taking place on this topic in an ancient water tower. Together with Guy Standing, an alderman of the city of Groningen, and a few scientists, the experts discuss a proposal for an experiment with unconditional welfare in Groningen.
I think if you take a community of 2,000, then you're going to have a very good experiment. I'm confident that you would have a very good experiment. And then you can test the effects, both the effects for the individual, effects for the community, a sense of solidarity and types of work. And those things
can be studied at a community level.
And I think when we set up experiments in Dutch cities, we should not neglect this social dynamic. I think it should be a starting point.
There are several districts that are low-income districts that have a lot of unemployment. This area of Bijen, there's some area called De Hoogte, which is here. And we have like the Indian neighborhood, is here.
In the Netherlands, there's been a new law. I mean, you can tell a bit about it, maybe. The participation law. And basically, it's a sort of decentralization where the local government has more authority or ways to work with this.
Local governments are allowed to experiment with the aim of finding better practices, being more efficient, but also stimulating people to leave benefits and to seek employment.
So just to summarize, to get clear for myself here, you're saying if you you take a geographically bordered area, and you say that everybody in that area who is on social assistance is now treated the same way via, for example, unconditional assistance, then that would give interesting results for the sake of research.
Absolutely. We, the scientists, can decide on the evaluation of the experiment. Yeah. But first things first, I think. But it all depends on getting clearance of the politics, politicians to do the experiments.
When I think about experiments, I don't bother about what politicians tell me what you can and you cannot do. It's also political will and political courage which is needed. Yeah. And I often say, I'm also chairman of two Rekenkamers, and I say to the wethouders, in this time of decentralization, you should do also this to Den Haag.
The speaker holds up a solitary middle finger.
That's what we are not allowed, and I think we should very much look at
you are never allowed. You are never allowed to change the system if you want to change.
We should look beyond the law.
Beautiful love, you're all a mystery. Beautiful love, what have you done to me?
Relatie arbeid en inkomen, dat is een oude relatie. Hè? Betaald werk, dat levert inkomen op. Nou, wij denken, en dat zie je ook, dat betaald werk...
The link between labor and income is an old one.
Toegankelijk is.
Paid labor creates an income, but what we see now is that it's not available to everyone, and it's not constant, and worse, that it makes unpaid work invisible and undervalued. Voluntary work, looking after the sick and handicapped, raising children. So we say, remove the link. Your income is guaranteed.
Betaalde arbeid,
and you'll see at the other end that all types of labor, paid or unpaid, will be much more equal and get much more attention. If people are free to choose, they'll start doing what needs to be done. That's much more important than seeing everything in terms of paid labor, which is the underlying problem. A lot of the things we do are undervalued. So we say, look at the social value of what people do and reward it, but not with money. Everyone is entitled to a basic income. It's a civil right. Everyone has the right to live a normal life and get the things they need to be happy. Why should we deny people that right just because they can't find paid work? Do they need a constant reminder that they are losers? Of course not.
Omdat ze geen betaald werk kunnen vinden.
Politicians cannot guarantee paid work for everybody.
Van de ene vernedering.
We see that every day. So we should forget that notion.
De politici kunnen ons niet meer garanderen dat iedereen betaald werk heeft. Dat blijkt elke dag weer. Dus moeten ze dat idee gewoon loslaten.
Who are these people living in this kind of insecurity? Guy Standing has come up with a new term for them, the precariat. The word combines precarious with proletariat and represents a growing number of people who live in a state of permanent uncertainty about their social and economic well-being.
If you're up here in the income sale and the salariat and the elite, you have total security. If you're down in the precariat, you have none. You are desperate. You have no security at all. You have to do what somebody tells you you have to do. So a struggle for the redistribution of security is fundamental to it. Now, for a transformation to happen, the emerging mass class must start to identify itself as that. A sense of recognition. So instead of somebody looking in the mirror in the morning and seeing a failure, seeing an incompetent person, moving from that to looking in the mirror in the morning and saying, wait a minute, I'm one of millions. The structures are creating these circumstances, and I belong to a group. I am part of the precariat.
And there's some beautiful shots of the Free Cafe in Groningen. Teams of volunteers doing various food serving type activities. And the speaker is Frans Kerver.
Wat ik gewoon zelf nu merk is, op het moment dat ik stress heb over geld.
What I feel is that when I'm stressed out about money, it changes my outlook on the world. I'm much more mistrustful. I tend to label people much more quickly. I think things like, yeah, yeah, easy for you to say with your income.
Ja, nee, je kijkt met een veel.
So I have this quite miserable way of looking at people around me, even though there's no reason really, and it would be much more pleasant to assume that most people are honest and honorable, which is probably true. And most people are altruistic, or at least try to have a good life together.
Altruistisch of geneigd om het een beetje leuk met elkaar te hebben.
We are trying to crowdfund for the basic income.
For one person?
No. Yeah, not for one person. It's we found the idea in Berlin. There's this guy. He made it for the seventh person to get a basic income. The same idea we want to start now here in Holland. And, well, Mislap, I said I would do it. I will be the first candidate.
Okay, so if you...
So I'll get very rich, Rachel!
You'll get very, very rich. What are you going to do with your money?
Yeah, that's a strange thing. I don't think I do very different things. I want to do these things I do. I'm busy with here, with Tyne in the Stad. I'm trying to do something for the Free Cafe. And I feel these urge that are the things I have to do. Okay. It's just like what you are doing. It's natural to do these things you are now doing.
Groningen has a green hub called the Garden in the City. Each Wednesday and Sunday it hosts the Free Cafe, where free meals are served made from rescued food.
The main problem is that in this country, they're saying, if a man will not work, he shall not eat. It's translated as, you must have a paid job. But I think, I work for my food, but I just don't get paid. There was a time when I made lots of money and never worried about it. Then we had the financial crisis, and I lost some clients. I made a living as a copywriter, but I was fed up sitting at the desk all day. I love doing this, and I think it's valuable, but there's no money in it.
Daar is heel moeilijk geld voor te krijgen. Hier op Tuin in de Stad.
Garden the City attracts a lot of people. Some have jobs. Many are on social security. Some have a psychiatric history. Some have burnout. We have disabled people, young people, old people. We welcome anyone who wants to do some work here.
Wij zeggen, okay, hartstikke mooi.
Find your niche. Do something you enjoy.
Wij bieden geen enkel perspectief.
But we offer no perspective. And there's no compensation.
Zeker weten dat wie hier komt vanuit.
We want to make sure that those who come here find their own compensation. That's all we can offer. So the people who work here are inherently strongly motivated. There's no other way. When you talk to them, you learn that what they are actually trying to do is to live their lives according to their own insights, while getting as little hassle as possible from the social security people who send them money.
And
it's not because they're fraudulent or lazy or trying to live off social security. It's because there are no jobs for them.
Omdat er geen banen zijn.
How do we deal with the disappearance of job opportunities? Can we create new jobs, or must we reinvent ourselves? Michael Bormeyer and his colleague, both from Germany, are in New York to introduce their basic income project overseas.
Wie geht's?
Gut, und dir?
Ausgezeichnet. Klasse, dass ihr da seid, ja. Super.
Albert Wenger, born in Germany, is a major startup investor in New York. He's interested in the impact of technology on society and regards the current shift in the meaning of labor as an opportunity to rethink the system.
One of the things that self-perpetuates the existing system, the system that just says, well, you have to work in order to make money. Why do you need to make money in order to afford these things? And once you've bought them, you're still not happy, so you have to work more. And so even people who have jobs are on these incredible treadmills where they're working longer hours and more than ever before. So I think it's creating the best way to get away from that is to create an alternative somewhere else. And then people can slowly, for themselves, decide that that's where they want to be, where they'd rather be.
Albert Wenger invests in automation. Twitter and Kickstarter are a couple of the big names in his portfolio. His TEDx talk on automation and basic income unleashed a lively debate in the investment industry.
That's our idea. Maybe sometimes I have to switch to German, maybe in this case.
We reflect a lot. Johannes has a philosophy degree. We keep our eyes on the big picture, and we see two worlds colliding in the political arena. One is the system, the other is the individual. The individual tends to blame the system. It is a left-wing response. The bad system is the problem, and the system says, you're lazy, you don't work, but still get a basic income. There's growing hatred on both sides. Everyone is stuck and nothing happens. We aim to find the point of leverage in all these conflicts, the sweet spot, the common ground. So where is the interface in the basic income? Where is the common ground? A recent article in Die Zeit explained it very clearly. A monthly deposit of 1,000 euros. That's where the person in the system meet in terms of basic income.
Der Moment beim Grundeinkommen, wo System auf Mensch quasi direkt trifft.
I love the fact that you guys are just doing it, you know, because I think that is sort of the most important thing. A lot of why we invest in the internet and internet startups is because one of the things that the internet allows you to do is to do things without asking for permission.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we call it permissionless innovation. So we tend to invest in this idea of permissionless innovation of things that operate on the internet and create kind of new networks. That's sort of central to our investing thesis, is sort of the creation of new networks, whether that's marketplaces like Etsy or crowdfunding like Kickstarter. And the thing that I've become convinced of is that I think we're sort of at the beginning of a transition that is as profound as going from hunter-gatherers to agriculture and then from agriculture to industrial mm-hmm. society. And the thing that I'm most fascinated by is this idea that before we became agrarians, we, in a way, lived in a state of abundance. So if you look at the hunter-gatherer societies, they worked like 3 hours a day, and they were pretty happy, and they shared everything. And then it was only through this agrarian and industrial age that we kind of organized everything around the idea of scarcity. And it's scarce, and you know, you have to work, and you have to work hard and harder. And so now, the thing I'm fascinated by is that I think we can get back to a new form of abundance through digital technologies, which is why I think that digital technology, the internet, and this idea of things like basic income are yeah. strongly tied together.
We managed to get quite a lot of money through crowdfunding. The first campaign yielded 60 to 70,000 euros. But that's not enough. We want it to grow. That's why, from day one, we tried to take this basic income. We aimed for out of the economic system and implement our tools. We tried to achieve our goals, almost by hacking, to put it negatively. We installed this crowdbar. It was relatively simple. The toolbar appears as soon as you enter the site. It's passive advertising, not active. It's up to you whether you enter the VAT or not. People love it. It's wildly popular. 12,000 people have installed it. We get 200 euros a day towards a basic income.
I love that. There's several things I love about what you're doing. One is I love the idea of figuring out how this becomes something that is easily self-sustaining, that scales, that doesn't rely just on people continuing to give money, but that is embedded in people's daily lives. So I think that's really, really critically important. What can I do to help? I mean, I've sent some money, so I'm
going to
contribute to one of the basic incomes. But what other things do you think I can do to help? And I can send more money, too. That's one thing. But what are the things you think you most need?
Does social innovation belong with governments, or can we now suddenly...
I think we can innovate. We can have social innovation. Crowdfunding, we're investors in Kickstarter. Crowdfunding is a social innovation. It lets artists, creative people, even products be funded in a completely new mechanism, and that's a social innovation. I would argue that a lot of what's happening with online education is a form of social innovation because it's making education easily accessible, often for free or for very low cost, that previously would have cost thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. That's a form of social innovation. I don't think we need to wait for somebody in Washington, D.C. to decide that this is something that needs to happen, or Berlin or wherever the seat of your respective government may be. I think these are things we can start to work on just as we are today.
Because you are busy with digital innovation, do you feel personally responsible?
Some people have said, well, you just say this so you can happily invest in automation. But my view is we should happily want to invest in automation as humanity. I'm a believer that automation will provide us with the ability to have vast improvements in productivity, to make a high standard of living available to everybody, to make access to information, free education, free healthcare available to everybody. So I believe in automation. We don't want to somehow clamp down on it. But we have to then address what the consequences for individuals are from that degree of automation. And that, I believe, is best solved by just putting everybody on a safe floor. And that's what kind of a basic income guarantee provides. It provides a floor that allows people to afford food, shelter, clothing, access to the internet.
How do we afford basic income?
Well, one of the things that technology does is it actually makes everything cheaper. In the U.S., since the mid-1990s, consumer durables have actually already been getting cheaper. The only thing that's been getting more expensive are services, and within services, it's been primarily education and healthcare. Technology also making those cheaper. But the economy is producing this. It's not a question of can we afford this? It's just a question of, do we want to afford it? I think it should be very attractive to people on the right who believe in smaller government, who believe in individual self-sufficiency. I also think it should be completely attractive to people historically on the left who believe in redistribution. This is a very overt redistribution, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. Government is already in the business of redistribution. We're just being very coy about it, and I think this is simply saying some people are going to make a lot of money. We will tax them, and some other, we can tax other things that are making money, and we're going to take that money to provide this basic income, this basic enabler for everybody.
One of the main reasons why small-scale experiments are not translated into general policies is issues of affordability. How can we redistribute our financial resources? Alaska has a 30-year-old fund built up with oil revenues. All residents of Alaska receive an annual dividend. This turned Alaska from a poor state with major inequality issues into the state with the lowest poverty and inequality statistics in the USA.
Every resident of the state of Alaska gets a dividend check, and you have to be here for a calendar year before you are able to apply for a dividend.
So this year, I think we got $1,800, you know, per, so, you know, times four, it becomes, you know, quite a bit of money. In the past, you know, we've had much smaller checks, might be $800, you know, a check, so, you know, $3,500 or $4,000. So it just varies. We have a very varied source of income, and we still do a little bit of commercial fishing. For salmon. We also have a snow removal business when we have snowy winters. And we also have a restaurant supply business in which we supply restaurants with the type of wood that they use for smoking ovens and things like that. Very seasonal, as is now, since we have the warmest winter on record and it's raining in February and we have green grass, there's no snow to plow. So that's been a fairly substantial reduction in what we kind of, you know, roughly, you know, base our income on for the year.
I don't think the dividend is enough or regular enough to be a source of income from the state of Alaska, it coming once a year and at the most being, you know, maybe $2,000, sometimes being only $800. You couldn't depend on that. But as a parent saving for your child's education, if you save whatever you get for 18 years, that's enough to make a difference in a child's life and their future.
The Alaskans are very proud of their Alaska Permanent Fund. This revolutionary idea was introduced by Republican Governor Jay Hammond in close cooperation with former Senator Clem Tillion. Oil revenues are deposited in the fund and kept safe for future generations.
And Hammond was just a United States Marine fighter pilot in the Second World War fighting the Japanese Zeros.
Oh, no, there was no fear in Hammond. It's just that he couldn't be rough on people that needed to be rough. Oh.
Hey, what's the philosophy behind the fund?
The philosophy of it is the resources belong to the people, and therefore you should run it like a company. But we are the only land-grant state in the United States. We're the only one that were given 100 million acres to pick anywhere we wanted to pick, and that was what we had to support our government off. In Texas, the oil belongs to the rancher. Here, the oil belongs to the people. Now, this gray-bearded old guy in a suit, Jay Hammond. But the thing is that most of the pictures that I had with Jay
You can find them in the historical library and stuff, but remember, I had a fire in 1980, and I lost all of everything. When I found out that we're only getting 1% for oil, I set out with a great mixture, and it wasn't one single party. There were Democrats, Republicans, but it was nearly all the Young Turks. You know, the socialists wanted it because they believed that everything ought to belong to private. And I don't believe that way. I'm kind of fairly right-wing. But I do believe that in this case where we were given the oil, that I was now the representative of the owners of that oil. So we ended up with 12.5% royalty and up to 20% taxes to pay for the roads and the things that went in it. And we are converting our non-renewable resource to a renewable. And we have about $50 billion now. We should have had $480 billion if we'd put everything in. Now, I was involved in forming the permanent fund, which he was supportive of, but what he saw was the next step. How do you disperse it?
Here in Alaska, we have a constitution which is set up an investment account funded with a portion of our oil wealth, which would spin off dividends. I wanted to create a stock sharing concept and actually give people a share of dividend earning stock per year. To date, we have a program which each year sends a check to each and every Alaskan.
It has worked very well. And it is also a way of dispersing money without welfare.
Do you see a link between the dividend and the basic income guarantee idea? The idea of giving unconditional money to citizens in a way that makes them equal?
Not I. You know, that's the socialist dream. I'm not a socialist.
So something we did with our dividend checks is we used them for building a small schoolhouse on our property here so I could homeschool our girls. Haven't been out here for about a year. I had two girls, and I homeschooled for 13 years, and it was really nice to have a separate building. I know a lot of people homeschool in their own home, but because my older daughter was such a artist and like to do things and we like to travel, the homeschooling seemed like a good choice for us to have the flexibility and to have that extra money, to have that extra space made her education all the better. And she's been on the dean's list continually for 2 years at college, so it was a good investment. If the dividends are coming in, that's when the museum will have their fundraiser. That's when things kind of happen. And it comes to the individual, but so many individuals make a community, and then it goes back into the community. And I think that it's important not just for people who need the basics, but it's also important to the community for the income that does come in.
We're still building our home. We live in a dry cabin where we haul water, and it's pretty rough life, and we're building out of pocket. So the money has to come from somewhere, and those chunks of change, I make it running water this year. It's on the docket. We're hoping.
Well, if people spend it however they want. It's a democratic choice, I guess, what you want to do with it. And I suppose there must be a crab fisherman someplace that drinks it up when he doesn't catch any crab, but I don't know this person.
Is it just another form of redistribution?
Well, it's obvious. It's a pre-distribution before it gets into the hands of people that are going to distribute for the ordinary political purposes. It gets, part of it gets stopped and sent directly to every man, woman, and child in the state. I wouldn't say it was given, it's taken before it gets to the government coffers. It has a really good effect in that it keeps people at least somewhat interested in the operations of government. And any time there's a proposal to get into the permanent fund and spend it to make up for deficits in the state budget, people rise up in defense. And it's been on the ballot a couple of times, and I think the response was, 87% did not want a single penny from the permanent fund to be spent for anything except its already approved purposes, which is not all paying dividends. It does other things as well. Dividends, yes, well, it's as the inventor said, they thought that greed is a legitimate human emotion and that by appealing to people's greed, you could protect this for future generations. It's in the book.
So the dividend is this? The dividend is a way to appeal to people's greed?
Yes, to protect the fund. So no disrespect to people who need a guaranteed income, but that's really not what we were up to deliberately.
The Alaskan model has been a beacon of sense in the search for new ideas on distribution. If all the residents of Alaska receive a dividend from oil revenues, shouldn't all South Africans get a dividend from the diamonds and the people of Groningen from the gas?
Now, I think that's a very thought-provoking question on which to end the video, and a helpful line of reasoning if you're explaining to somebody whose first instinct is, well, nice idea, but we just don't have the money. Actually, none of the real world's problems are directly due to money. We may find we face these problems because money exerts an impact on people's thinking. For example, it makes people more selfish. That selfish behavior may manifest and create problems for the real world. Money is working in the modern world as a kind of a pump from the bottom 80-odd percent of society who pay money in aggregate to banks, interest and overdraft fees and so on. And the beneficiaries in the main are the top 1%. Obviously the top 0.001% gain a lot more. It's very, very polarized. Now, it's easy to see why there's a large amount of theory about why this is a good thing, and that's why we talk about have to keep growing the economy and so on. I think a dispassionate analysis would come to the conclusion that, as Guy Standing suggests, decoupling people's survival, people's food and shelter from this economic treadmill would be good for the majority of humanity. And perhaps all of humanity. I mean, another point that this film hasn't taken up is the trap of the 0.001% surrounded by people of a similar economic status. These people are also trapped by this system that shapes their expectations and their behaviors and focuses on selfish maximization. This is the expected behavior, and this is what is called success. I'm keen to try and avoid these sort of enemy images. As Marshall Rosenberg stated, these are people who have contrasting experiences with the 99%. Some of them have consciences, some of them are psychopaths. And that doesn't necessarily mean we can't, as 100%, work out a better way to be. As humans, we do have pretty much identical needs in terms of food and shelter and so on. And materially, I can see no reason why people should go without houses and go without food and so on. Humans have a need not to be under chronic stress, or they get sick and die. So that isn't only about material goods. 1% may not have that stress. They have other stresses, such as they're worried about the world economy or preference shares or whatever else. And the appeal of a solution for the 100%, a way of living that by design doesn't put people under chronic stress, is something that I think we must not underestimate to the 99% and the 1%. And a basic income would not solve all the problems of the money system, but by decreasing a lot of people's existential stress, increasing their health, giving them time to do things outside the money system, I think it would be a step in the right direction. And as such, it would also be an admission that, yes, capitalism has achieved some things. Universal security and peace and happiness is very unlikely to come about under a capitalist system. So if that's what we're aiming at, then let's start to explore the alternatives. The program doesn't explore the idea that if we had a basic income for every man, woman and child on the planet, would the money system actually continue to function for very long? That's an open question, but I suspect probably not. The money system is, after all, working in tandem with this if you shall not work for pay, you shall not eat system of blackmail to try to subvert people's natural and, I think, healthy instincts to make their own decisions about what they do in life, to try to subvert their will to the will of a tiny cabal who run the world's money system. I call it one system. I think the differences between national governments and national currencies are smaller than their similarities. And of course, you know, there's things like the Bank of International Settlements, where the central bankers meet and they plan to do things such as inflate the world currencies in concert to hide the fact that these bailouts are basically a global theft that's carried out in broad daylight. And I thought, how can I close this program? It's been a bit of a ramble, but it's been what's on my mind to share with you. These are some of the thoughts which I thought, well, I've had these growing in my mind for a long time, and I haven't perhaps clearly put them together in one place. I've emphasized the economic aspect because that's very clear to me, perhaps because I've lived in a range of countries and traveling back from Britain to Bangladesh, I've noticed even on my own behavior, in one country I feel like a rich person, in one country I feel like a poor person. Just that contrast has helped me to see how much of a fiction money actually is. I'd like feedback. I'd really love if you'd let me know what you thought of this show, because I don't do a lot of public speaking and I don't write books, and mostly I limit my contributions on the show to illustrating why I've chosen particular pieces or highlighting connections with other episodes that we've had on the show. I've kind of ad-libbed this program based on Illich's doubts about social power. So let's hear the original quote. This is from Unwelcome Guests, episode 523. I think this was a set of interviews from about 2001 with David Cayley.
Let me say 20 years ago, among the people with whom I usually deal, it's of course a very peculiar type of people, it was impossible to question that their responsibility for those children whom they saw in the ads of the children's fund with hunger blown up bellies were their responsibility. They were scandalized when I talked to them about responsibility being the soft underbelly of fantasies of about power, that the responsibility they felt was a way of justifying their sense that because they were from a rich country, we have some power to plan, to organize, to change the rest of the world. This responsibility, this ugly justification of blown-up power fantasies, is something about which, from experience I know this, during the last few years, I can make people laugh. Laugh about themselves, that they fell into this trap. A new sense of impotence is around. The future, which seemed something appropriable in terms of planning, designing, policy making, the very idea of policy making and policy execution, is receding very fast. It finds still expression with U.S. bombing Milosevic or Gaddafi or Iraq into a recognition of human rights of its own citizens. It still nourishes the new book by Rostov about the need of maintaining American police power worldwide. as a condition for the survival of democracy. But the people who speak to me, different from those who spoke to me, of the way they spoke to me 20 years ago, do recognize that there is a fallacy, that the world in which, in front of which they stand, not the future world, but the present world, is built on assumptions for which we haven't found the appropriate names yet. I speak with people who are beginning to understand that the language about the organization of power, prevalent between 50 and 80, has no hold on reality anymore. And no matter if they are people who come from an attempted philosophy of power structure, let me say Michel Foucault, or if they come from the Rostov corner, when 25 years ago, to his face, with people, I argued that in spite of my great admiration, Foucault assumed the existence of something, namely power, along the lines along which, after 1840, the idea of energy was socially constructed for the physical world, and power being something metaphorically corresponding in the social domain, people considered me evil, David. The recognition that we cannot help but renounce power, not because of a Gandhian or Christian spirit of renunciation to violence, but because the power which we sought 10 or 20 years ago reveals its own void, its own illusory characteristics.
This new feeling of impotence, of a void where the power to change the world was once thought to be, is for Illich the characteristic experience of the New Age. The world now confronts us as something unmanageable, as a complex, chaotic system of which we can never form a comprehensive view because we are inscribed within it. Such a world, Illich believes, gives rise to strange compensatory fantasies and reassuring rain dances which hide our helplessness. We dream of a return to Earth, a rebirth of Mother Nature, of ethical capitalism and global citizenship. But these fantasies, he says, only distract us from our fundamental powerlessness. Illich suggests a different path, a return to what he calls conspiratio. The conspiratio was the kiss by which the early Christian communities mingled their spirits and sealed their communion with one another. It was practiced at a time when Christians still sought to imitate their Lord's absolute refusal of power, a time when the Church had not yet made itself into the prototype of the modern state. To Illich, it symbolizes the way of love without power, free, self-giving love that meets no need and expects no guarantee, the love that stirred in the Samaritan's belly when he saw that half-dead man lying by the road. This way, Illich says, has reopened as the modern project of underwriting love with power has failed, and the modern institutions in which this project was embodied have ceased to inspire faith.
The credibility of the world constructed with the idea of citizenship, of responsibility, of power, of equality, of need, claim, and entitlement. The credibility of these as ideals for which it is worthwhile to consecrate your life is declining, in my opinion, very fast. Most people see this as a serious danger, which it is, to the survival of a democratic order. I want to suggest the possibility of seeing it as the end of an epoch, just like the Roman Empire, as a time of Augustus, and as an entirely new access, credibility, ease of moving into the world of conspiratio, knowing that it can't be contractually assured, insured. A renunciation to insurance.
And all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you'd like to get more involved in the show, you can join the mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome. Now, thanks to Patricia, who emailed me a couple of days back. She asked me, can I get your podcast on iTunes or Pocket Cast? I know nothing about iTunes or Pocket Cast. This is produced as a bunch of MP3s. We do also have an RSS feed and an Atom feed, both of which are created programmatically, so they should be updated whenever the website is updated. If that's enough information for anyone out there to put us onto Pocket Cast or iTunes or anywhere else, then feel free. You've got my blessing to spread this information. This show is an open source production. If you'd like to discuss collaboration, how you can help spread this message, if you'd like this included in some kind of compilation or whatever else, you can email me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. And of course, I'd love to hear your feedback on this episode or suggestions for future episodes.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Jerry Brown, Last Chance to Do the Right Thing.
I've seen too much killing, and not just on TV. Since 1976, over 1,400 women and men have been executed in our prisons. Some were later found to be innocent. In California, 743 people in cages on death row wait to die. 60% are people of color. 20 states where people are safe have no death penalty. Why do we? It's a dark time in America. Join me in asking Governor Brown to declare a moratorium on executions and commute all death sentences to life in prison. For a just, moral state, end the death penalty in California.
That's Mike Farrell, activist, humanitarian, actor, and author, president of Death Penalty Focus. He's appealing to Jerry Brown as Brown is getting ready to leave office at the end of December 2018. Death Penalty Focus is an abolition organization with an educational nonprofit status. I heard Mike Farrell's appeal on Tom Hartman's program on December 4 and got permission to quote from their conversation. Here's Mike Farrell.
Here in California, we have the largest death row in the nation. You know, the death penalty really brutalizes us all. It's racist in application. It costs a hell of a lot more money than does keeping people in prison for the rest of their lives, if necessary. And it entraps and kills innocent people. So it's simply a blot on everything that we believe this country is about. And more we've come to the understanding, we as a people are coming to the understanding that we really don't need this and it's not serving us.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, but of the OECD countries, the 34 developed countries in the world, I think we're the only one that still has a death penalty, aren't we?
Yes, that's right. As a matter of fact, in order to become a member of the European Union, you have to agree to give up the death penalty. Today, there are only about 35, I think, killing countries.
In the entire world?
in the world.
It's remarkable. George Herbert Walker Bush having died this weekend and being buried on Wednesday, there's been a renewed conversation, particularly among communities of color, particularly in the African-American community, about how consequential Bush's decision in 1988 to use the Willie Horton ad in order to become president, how consequential that decision was, because in large part what it did is it caused the Democrats, specifically Bill Clinton, who became president 4 years later, to conclude that that in order to beat a Republican like Mike Dukakis had failed to do, you had to be, you know, tough as nails, quote, tough on crime, and that meant cracking down on people of color, cracking down on welfare for people of color, and, you know, beating your chest and roaring about, you know, the death penalty, which is mostly disproportionately applied to people of color. And that was the story in many regards of the Clinton presidency, you know, right through minimum mandatory sentences and all this kind of stuff. It seems to me that outside of the angry white echo chamber that exists in right-wing hate radio and Fox News, which is perhaps 20% of the American population, and Trump world. Outside of that, it seems like Americans left, right, and center are waking up to the obscenity of the death penalty. And do you agree with that analysis of that 88 election?
Oh, indeed. It wasn't the first, obviously. I mean, we've been doing this for years, but it was the most egregious in the modern era, I think. From that point, the death penalty used to be what was known as the third rail of Democratic politics. You just couldn't touch it. You couldn't say that you didn't like it. You couldn't say that you opposed it. You really had to be, as you suggest, tough on crime and killing all the people. And Clinton went down to Arkansas and presided over the execution of Ricky Ray Rector, a brain-damaged man who didn't know that he was actually being executed and left the dessert for his last meal in the cell from which he was taken for when he returned.
Wow.
In the last 10 years, we have now had 10 states, Washington State being the most recent, give up the death penalty, some through legislative action, some through gubernatorial action, and always with the result being that instead of the crime rate rising, as people suggest, number of murders rising, it's been just the reverse. And the savings in money, and I hate to put a dollar and cents a tag on the issue of life, but in terms of the expenditure of tax money, wasting it on killing people and maintaining the kind of systems that do such harm, not only to the people that are executed, but to the people who are doing the executing, the people who we deputize to take lives in our name and suffer for it.
Yeah. What can we do about this? We're talking with Mike Farrell, the actor, activist, humanitarian, author, and president of Death Penalty Focus. Deathpenalty.org is the website. DP Focus is the Twitter handle. What do I do?
Well, one thing they can do is contact Governor Brown. Jerry Brown, we all know, philosophically opposes the death penalty. For some reason, he has refused to stand up on the issue since he's been in office this second time. He didn't support either of our initiatives in 2012 or 2016 to do away with the death penalty. He didn't oppose it, but he didn't support it, which would have been all the difference. But what he can do now in the next weeks, he's going to remain in office, is a number of things. He can simply declare a moratorium on death, say it is wrong, and begin the process of commuting sentences of death to sentences of life.
This would be a legacy builder.
Absolutely. I think it would be something that would accrue to his place in history in an extraordinary way because, as I said before, California has we have 743 women and men on our death row in California.
Wow.
That's almost 25% of the entire country's death row. And if he were to end that, it would elevate him in the status in every way you can think of.
Right.
But it would also begin a process that I think is inexorable. It's happening anyway. Oregon probably will be next. Kansas is looking at it. There are so many of these states that have come to realize it serves them not at all. But I think Brown's action really could be the coup de grace, if you will,
right.
in this to this awful policy.
Thanks to Louise and Tom Hartman for permission to use clips from Tom's conversation with Mike Farrell. I explained to the Hartmans that I had a rare recording of Jerry Brown from 1998 when he was presenting himself as a recovering politician, and that I wanted to run it alongside the appeal to remove California from the list of killing states. You will hear in a moment how insightful, even prescient, Jerry Brown's analysis of politics was in 1998. But it was astounding that he even chided his own father, Pat Brown, when he used being tough on crime to get elected in 1943. Jerry Brown.
You're supposed to talk about potholes and crime and education, which are all important, but they're a mantra of meaninglessness because they never change. It's just more of the lie. I know when I say my father lied because he didn't, well, you judge. But anyway, in his first campaign in 1943, when he ran for district attorney, I was five then, the slogan was, crack down on crime, pick Brown this time. So I figured my campaign slogan, it's already written. They're all the same. So what we need here is not rhetoric, we need is action.
Brown spoke to organic farmers at the annual EcoFarm conference in Asilomar, California, on January 21st, 1998. When I ran the full talk on KALW later that year, I got a call from a reporter at the Oakland Tribune. He had just attended a Jerry Brown campaign rally for mayor of Oakland, a job Brown ended up holding from 1999 to 2007. On his way home, the reporter listened to my program and said that he was astounded by the difference in Brown's tone and content at the rally. In a matter of a few months, Brown had made his father's mantra of meaninglessness his own, and were now on a tough-on-crime platform. After holding political office from 1999 to 2018 as mayor and attorney general of California, ending on a third and fourth term as governor of California, Jerry Brown has termed and timed out of politics and has an opportunity to take action on principles he clearly once held. He is part of Jerry Brown's keynote to organic farmers in January 1998. It then earned him a standing ovation.
People told me to come down here and tell you all to go to vote, but I wouldn't know who I should tell you to go to vote for. Because the way this thing is organized, the important stuff is never talked about. And the little peccadilloes are raised to the level of national crisis. And that is not without malice, because the real fundamental issue is there's a premise here, and that premise doesn't work. And it's the guiding premise on which contemporary politics operates. It was probably best stated by President Truman in 1949 when he declared the decade of development. And at that point, he enshrined the notion in its most formal statement that America was developed and all these other countries in the world were undeveloped. And so it was our mission, since we won in World War II, now we had another mission, and that was to go develop all these underdeveloped people, which was the vast majority of mankind. Now, it just so happens that most of mankind didn't know they were underdeveloped until they had been so designated. And this is a very old story. The Greeks had a term for anyone who didn't speak Attic Greek. It was called barbaros, barbarian. And the Christians came along, and if you weren't a Christian, you were a pagan. And then after a while, they developed other concepts like infidels to distinguish from Christians. And then at the Enlightenment, and then Europe got civilized, humanized, progressivized, and they started to go out and discover the native. They didn't have natives until about 500 years ago. They got the idea of natives. and then there's us, and there's them. And therefore, 70 million people had to die because they were natives. And they had to be converted, and they had to be brought up to the standards of civilization. In fact, this thing goes into more recent times. Woodrow Wilson said something in regard to Mexico, and actually just a lot of these countries, I think Mexico was one of them, that we had to teach them, we being the Americans, had to teach them order and discipline. That kind of will ring rather hollow, at least around the White House and other places. This idea of development is the idea that we got it, we're on the right track, but as soon as they get more of it, then they'll feel good and we'll all feel good and we'll all have peace. That, in kind of a short version, is the reigning doctrine. And what it's really about is that, well, it takes 200 million cars to move 260 million Americans, and that means if you want to move the Chinese in similar style, it'll take 1 billion cars. And then you do figure out for the Indians, and then a few more, and you have the need for at least 5 more planets, which are not available. If the Chinese, now that they're so big and powerful, if they dared to adapt the taste, the eating taste, in terms of fish, of their neighbors, the Japanese, do you know how many fish that would take every year? If they just ate the same amount of fish as the Japanese, all the people in China, it would take all the fish that the sea can produce, about 100 million tons. Unthinkable. And if you look at each of these items, these indices of progress and advancement and civilization, and you generalize them without any changes, the whole thing collapses. And so the notion that development, and you hear that, you got to develop them. First, that now that they're through with communism, you got to develop them. Well, the concept of development itself is exhausted. It's at its outer limit. Now, it may take, I don't know how many years or decades to sputter out. It may take a few centuries. But as a galvanizing, organizing idea, it leaves a lot to be desired. And I believe that this notion that many people grew up in, that we've got it, it's the American way, and we just take it to the rest of the world, and then everything's going to be fine someday. Well, since Truman proposed the development decade in 1949, the gap between the rich and the poor has doubled. In fact, between 60 and 90, the gap between the rich and the poor has increased. The gap at home is increasing between the very wealthy and the very poor. And you have a tremendous amount of anxiety because there's very little that you can really hold on to because the driving force in everything now is this market concept, which is the return on investment. And when you start applying that to everything, it doesn't give you a lot to hold on to. In fact, it's never been done before. Every civilization, until probably 100, 200 years ago, always had a very large part of their culture and their society anchored in some non-market principle. Religion, custom, ancestor worship, taboos, a grove. There were spaces, there were practices that were not subject to buy and sell, to fluctuating incentives and prices. Today, that space is diminishing almost to the point of disappearance. And that's the world in which we live. So when we look at anything, it's always within that guise. And that's the battle, whether it's for organic agriculture, for sustainability, to preserve a neighborhood, to preserve the last 4% of redwood groves in this state. It's up against the most powerful religious idea that is extended further and deeper than any idea in the history of the world. And that is this idea of modernity, progress, buy and sell. For example, if you look at a tree, if it's around for 1,000 years, you could either call it a wasting asset, as Charles Hurwitz saw it, or you can see it as, there it is. And there's the habitat and Let's look at it. Let's appreciate it. Awe. You know, just how do you incorporate that into an efficiency development model? It doesn't fit. And that's why Hurwitz acted rationally when he leveraged Pacific Lumber and started and doubled the cut, because decks and wet bars can be measured. They go into the gross national product. A tree or a grove or a bird or a fish isn't in the gross national product. It's not measured. And today, everything is into the measure. Measure is very important. The time, the value, the quantity. That's the powerful idea. And that's why this whole notion, if you take the market and you add it to technology, you get ships that can go out to sea for 6 months, that have nets that stretch for miles, that are in contact with satellites and sonar technology and refrigeration capacity. I mean, they just go. And the fewer the fish, the higher the price, so the quicker you take what's ever left. So it's a mad psychology, and yet it is the reigning doctrine. So what's happening is we have an ideology that's so pervasive, it's so embedded into the conventional political game, that to get into that game is to accept mass brainwashing. It's to enter into a kind of hope that is hopeless, because you just sink into it and you start saying, well, is Gore going to be better than Clinton? And is Gray Davis going to be better than Feinstein? And is this going to be better than that? Well, there are differences. Yes, there are very fine differences that I could articulate for you. But if you stand back and you ask about the issues that really count, about what is, you know, what is happening in the inner city, what's happening to our health, has the war on cancer with its $30 billion, has it reduced the mortality? No. Caused by cancer in 1962, since accurate records, age adjusted, have been kept, has not been, no reduction in mortality, none. And somebody writes a story, writes a wonderful book about it. It's reviewed in the New England Journal of Medicine by W.R. Grace, toxicologist, one of the biggest chemical companies around. And he pans it, called it paranoia. Environmentalists are paranoid. Well, that got a little exposed. But there are these fundamental issues of how human beings can be in harmony with nature. What's the wisdom that we can pick up from our ancestors? What differences exist in the world, and can we understand that? Can we really grasp the hypocrisy when even a Pete Wilson wouldn't tolerate drilling off the Monterey coast? But all of us use the gasoline from Exxon, which in part is going to come from places in Ecuador where people have lived a certain way for hundreds of years and their life will be wiped out, all for progress. You can't leave oil in the ground. It's there. You got to grab it. It's like you have to go get the gold and the mineral out of the Black Hills. There is no principle of restraint in the present order of things. In the development era, development is the good. And anything that goes against it is Luddite, cuckoo, strange, and sometimes they would call it moonbeam. I've had run into that one. They'll pull anything out. That's if you buy into that. And I'm really telling you tonight, buy out of it. And that's what organic farming is all about. It's buying out of a corrupt system that's dangerous, that's lethal, and it's killing the planet. So when people say, well, as long as we get our label, we'll take a little irradiation, I say, no irradiation, until you can tell me all the, you know, why do you need irradiation? How about a little toxic sludge? Put that in the garden. Get it right out of there from the swamps of the South Bronx. That'll go good. Just ship it over to Texas and grow some good organic tomatoes and sell them in the farmer's market on Sunday morning. I mean, come on. You're not going to go for that, are you? And what's the other one? Oh, yeah, these genetic trans genetic, whatever they call it. They got stuff now where they're actually bringing rats out of cows. They didn't quite make it yet. But there was the, miscarriage. But they're trying it. And here's the thing that's so amazing. All that this great, rotten political system can come up with in response when they say human cloning, we better study it. We better take a 10-year moratorium on that one. Why don't we have a 10-year moratorium on slavery? Can we just hold it off for 10 years? Then we can check it out. See, no moral base. There's nothing human here. It's an out-of-control paradigm. It's a model of madness that is now masquerading as common sense. It's only people who would come to this conference who can see that. And you got to tell everybody because they don't get it. They're really wondering, did Clinton do it or not? And they're going to spend the next 6 months thinking about that while they're eating a bunch of poison that's been irradiated with toxic sludge added on top with a little genetic manipulation on the side. See, the game of economics is infinite desires. And what is produced more efficiently even than the stuff and the services is the desires for the stuff. So along with everything that's made and produced and sold and propagandized is this creation of more and more human desires from us to the people in India to all over the planet. And that's called progress. So there's where we are. And you join here, you come together to talk about one aspect of this big picture, a world with a completely bankrupt idea. There is the knowledge and there is the clarity to live in a way that makes sense and that you yourself know. And by demonstrating that and by exemplifying it and by learning more about it and by sharing it, who knows what the impact will be? But that has power. Truth has power. Truth has power in the age of the lie. And we are in the age of the lie. This is the context of organic agriculture. It is a philosophy. It's a way of life. It's an insight. It's a total commitment. And this is what the world needs. This is what other people need. This is what all of us need to understand how we can live in ways that make sense and that are respectful of the other and the other person, the other way of life, the other species, the other expressions of this incredible complexity called reality. I am responding not by being on a farm, but by being in the city. And while that is viewed very weirdly, you're supposed to talk about potholes and crime and education, which are all important, but they're a mantra of meaninglessness because they never change. They never change. It's just more of the lie. I know when I say my father lied because he didn't, well, you judge. But anyway, in his first campaign in 1943, when he ran for district attorney, I was five then, my first campaign, the slogan was, crack down on crime, pick brown this time. So I figured my campaign slogan, it's already written. They're all the same. So what we need here is not rhetoric. We need action. We need actual things going on. Stuff coming out of the ground. People doing things. People standing up for what they know. And then these other things, the common sense, the beauty of it, the power, will then begin to put other things in line. If we can link the cities with farmers, community-supported agriculture, if we can get it into the schools, if we can get this, I don't know, no school schools or something where things really happen, where you grow things, you learn about biology and natural history and how to make things, how to use your hands as well as your head, as well as the television and the computer, then we're going to get somewhere. So that's the context. And so it's a very exciting moment. Don't have hope in what you hear, read, or see, but what you know, taste, and feel, and grow. And together, we'll change something. Thank you very much.
That was part of Jerry Brown's keynote to organic farmers on January 21st, 1998, while he was still a recovering politician. Soon he fell off the wagon, adopted a tough-on-crime policy, and had a second, almost two-decade-long career as mayor, attorney general, and governor in California. He was presiding over a killing state with the largest population of inmates on death row in the country. He again is the appeal by death penalty focus to set that right before he leaves office.
In California, 743 people in cages on death row wait to die. 60% are people of color. 20 states where people are safe have no death penalty. Why do we? Join me in asking Governor Brown to declare a moratorium on executions and commute all death sentences to life in prison. For a just, moral state, end the death penalty in California.
That's the appeal by deathpenalty.org, with a link to the petition. Thanks to the Tom Hartmann Program for allowing me to quote from Tom's interview with Mike Farrell, president of deathpenalty.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelaudin. Thank you for listening.
To Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Those of us in the first world who live relatively comfortable lives, at some level, we know that the material comfort with which we live is built on the backs of people primarily in the global south, in the third world. And we know that's inconsistent with our own moral principles. We know it violates our concern for the fundamental dignity of all people and for equality.
That's the voice of Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Robert Jensen about his book, All My Bones Shake, and society's four fundamentalisms that we need to deal with to move forward in a healthy way. So stay tuned.
We are privileged to have as our guest Dr. Robert Jensen. He teaches media law, ethics, and politics at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Get Enough, The Heart of Whiteness, Citizen of the Empire, and Right in Dissent. His latest book is All My Bones Shake. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Jensen.
Great to be with you, Sylvia.
At the root of the current political economy and ecological chaos is a national religious unrest that is thwarting our self-awareness and slowing our spiritual progress to a glacial crawl. This is a quote from the cover on your book. In our society, we seem to think of religion as the belief in some type of deity, whether that be a Christianity religion, Muslim religion, or any kind of religion. I would argue there seems to be another religion, and that is the religion of the marketplace, where we accept things as the natural result of the marketplace. And you actually covered this in your book. So for our audience, where does this come from? Where does this blind faith in the market come, and how does it manifest?
Well, of course, you're right that we talk about religion and spirituality and faith and the things that define us. But in reality, in the contemporary United States, and the truth is it's blanketed much of the world, there is a kind of market fundamentalism, an economic fundamentalism that not only claims capitalism is the best way to organize an economy, but claims it's the only way, it's the natural way. It's an attempt to make a set of human choices about how to distribute the wealth of the world as if they were natural, as if they were beyond critique. And that's a kind of core definition of fundamentalism, a belief in a set of principles with absolute certainty in a way that can't be challenged. But, of course, an economy is a set of human choices. Why do we accept this market fundamentalism? Well, part of it is simply the effort that has been put into a propaganda system by mostly a relatively small elite to get ordinary people to believe that the incredibly unequal distribution of wealth in the world is somehow unavoidable. But, of course, we know it's not. And we know that we have within our grasp, if we were to do so, ways to devise an economy that would not be perfect, that would still require a lot of struggle, but would not produce the profound inequality which now structures the world economy. I would just remind listeners that as we speak, about half the world's population, according to the World Bank, more than 3 billion people on this planet today live on less than $2.50 a day U.S. for everything, food, shelter, education, medical. That is, half the population lives in a kind of abject poverty. I would want to believe that that is not our only option, that there are other ways to devise an economy. And I think, paradoxically, although in this country many people who identify as Christians also accept this market fundamentalism, I think Christianity is a source of resistance to this fundamentalism. And in the progressive fashioning of an understanding of Christianity, I think there is a lot of hope.
One of the things you address in your book is you say there are four fundamentalisms. So I wonder, you talked about the market fundamentalism and how we see this invisible hand sort of fixing everything and the market dictating the choices. So it implies that citizens have choices. So perhaps we should start by addressing the issue of choice then, because if you are a Haitian, your choices are very different than if you are a worker in Canada or the U.S. So how is this constructed and maintained, this myth of equality and democracy in our society?
Well, of course, first of all, we should recognize that within the contemporary corporate capitalist system, it's not a complete myth. There is some freedom to choose, and there is some movement from people who begin in low socioeconomic places and rise up. That is, there is a kernel of truth to the notion in capitalism that anybody can make it. Certainly there are people who were raised poor who became wealthy. Certainly there is some level of choice in the system. But the question is, does everyone have meaningful choices with the kind of equality that makes it possible to truly choose? And the answer there is, of course, no, because capitalism has been and always will be, from my point of view, a wealth-concentrating system. And kind of the lie of capitalism is the idea that everybody can make it. But, of course, the system is premised on not everyone making it. And when we look across time and space, we see that historically that relatively small elite, which has for the most part been concentrated in the first world, in Europe, the United States, Japan, a few other places, has used its power. It's used force, violence, coercion. It's used all of that to maintain that inequality. Well, I think when you step back and look at the whole system, one sees that capitalism is, in fact, inconsistent with democracy, because the way capitalism concentrates wealth leads to a concentration of political power. One can see that capitalism is inconsistent with our own principles and values about what it means to be a human being, a belief in the dignity of all people, a belief in equality. And for those reasons, I think capitalism is fundamentally incompatible with Christianity. I think to take seriously the text and the tradition of the Christian faith is to be anti-capitalist. And in fact, if one looks back at the early Christians in the first two or three centuries after Christ was killed, you see that many people in that era believed that to be a Christian was to live communally, to share, to renounce private property. Well, that's not capitalism, in case anybody isn't clear. All right, so the Christian tradition itself is rooted in a rejection of the inequality and materialism that defines capitalism. I think the principles of Christianity, when appropriately understood today, would lead to a rejection of the current capitalist system. And that's why in the book I try to root myself in that Christian tradition, which is the tradition of the culture I come out of. And I think the struggle to define what that Christianity means is very important.
You brought two very important points, and I think that's how religious has been sort of thwarted to be in favor of capital and economic fundamental principles. And I just want to point out that I recently interviewed Bruce Gagnon. He pointed out that, you know, with the election of President Obama, everyone was celebrating a shift and change. And yet, he says, you know, in 1 year, President Obama has done what no other Republican has ever done in the history of the U.S. And he turned $12.3 trillion in bailouts. Nine out of every $10 was given to the banks. And I'm reminded of the story in the Bible where Jesus spoke against this. And this idea that we accept certain policies blindly, I think, needs to be addressed. I'm trying to reconcile the fact that we take this as a, you know, without challenging. On one hand, we say the bailouts needed to be given. Why? Who profits in an economic crisis? Who's profiting out of the massive military budgets that are being issued? So it seems to me there's a structure behind this. Can you speak to this?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Of course, in times of crisis, there is always a push on the part of elites to define the crisis as unmanageable without immediate action from the top. And, of course, sometimes that's true. If your country is being invaded by another country, perhaps that might be true. But with an economic crisis like the one we just lived through, or are still living through, there was another option, and that option was to rethink the fundamental nature of the system, to use the crisis not simply to shore up and reinforce the inequality in the existing system, but to ask, is this a moment where we can devise something new? And that can happen with the input of everyone. There could have just as easily been a process when the subprime mortgage crisis hit to convene a kind of national conversation about what we want in an economy. And I think that the reason that didn't happen was not because it was impossible, but because people with power didn't want it to happen. And I think the tension around this is mounting. Ordinary people increasingly, even people who 5-10 years ago would have endorsed the capitalist system in the United States on the assumption that it would provide for them, are now seeing that the people who run that capitalist system really don't care about ordinary people, and that ordinary people are starting to push back and to recognize their real fate in that system. Now, I think the real important moment for those of us who consider ourselves politically active or organizers or community activists is, can we marshal that resentment into positive channels to challenge the system? You know, Barack Obama happens to be the guy running things at the moment, but it's not the guy running things at the moment in Washington who really holds power. It's the people who control the productive capacity of the country, the capitalists in that sense, the owners and the high-level managers. And we have to challenge them. And then eventually, if we're successful, we give the Barack Obamas of the world a choice. You either sink your fate in with the people, or you ally yourself with the wealthy and the privileged, and it's a choice then politicians have to make. You know, all of this is a long-term struggle that's been going on for decades, centuries, in which ordinary people have been trying to take control of our own lives. And this is a moment where I think there are things possible precisely because of the crisis.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the fundamentalism, this fundamentalism that you speak of in your book, of the state, this nationalism that promotes or sometimes blinds people to the actions of their government. How does this unfold? And you know, because it seems every empire has always justified whatever crimes they commit as being in the interest of the people, this sort of benevolent empire. How does it manifest, and why should we be aware of it and fight against it?
I think you're, again, hitting on an incredibly important subject, especially here in the United States, which is kind of the empire of the modern world at this point. You know, as you point out, most imperial powers in the past, whether it was Britain, France, you know, for a brief time Germany, Russia, they often justified their crimes around the world, the crimes that exploited the resources of other places, and oppress the people of those places. They justified those crimes as somehow being in the interests of advancing civilization, of civilizing the natives. These are very, you know, obvious justifications and failed justifications. Of course, no serious person would believe them today. Yet here in the United States, we have our own imperial justifications, mostly around the idea of bringing democracy to other parts of the world. Well, we have to break down that fundamentalism, that sort of unthinking acceptance of a set of principles that really don't conform to reality. Does the United States bring democracy to the world? Well, I think we can look across the board, especially in the post-World War II era at U.S. interventions, and see that, in fact, the United States has done more to thwart democracy in other parts of the world than to advance it. So just as we have to break down the notion that markets and capitalism are inevitable, that fundamentalism must be challenged. So must the fundamentalism around the special role of the United States, the idea that the United States, by definition, is always doing good in the world. Well, a lot of people in the United States hold on to that fundamentalist notion as well. And I think all we're saying is that, you know, reality does not conform to fundamentalist notions. Reality is complex. Reality has a historical base that we have to try to understand. Reality includes an honest accounting of power, privilege, and oppression. And when we do that, of course, the fundamentalism melts away, just as I think it does in the religious arena, that when you fully understand the complexity of the human experience, it's hard to hold on to fundamentalisms. And that's what we have to do, is kind of ruthlessly tell the truth about this country, this economy, and our place in the world.
Your book also talks about the technological fundamentalism, and I want to address this, because we are living in an era of, particularly in Latin America, of incredible aggression. We see the coup in Honduras taking place, and the world has stood up and denounced the coup. And in many cases, we defend these policies as this developmental idea. And technology sort of goes hand in hand. But I think technology in the interest of whom? And technology for whom? So what do you mean by the technological fundamentalism? How do you see it being counterintuitive to a society that is inclusive and pluralistic?
I think here the critique and concern about a kind of high-energy, high-technology life is rapidly spreading. The one thing we know without question is that the fundamental health of the ecosystem that makes our own lives possible is in dramatic decline, and that decline is overwhelmingly because of human intervention into the ecosystem in ways that are not sustainable. It's the way we farm. It's the way we extract materials from the world. It's the way we dump toxins back into that world. Everyone understands, at least everyone who's willing to tell the truth, that we have created a system based on the high energy potential of coal, oil, and natural gas, and the technological advances that have come with that, that we based a system on an unsustainable relationship to the earth. Now, what I call, and others have called, technological fundamentalism is really the belief that whatever problems have come from that high-energy, high-technology world can be fixed with simply more high-energy, high-technology. And you see this over and over again. We talk about the energy problem, and there is a scrambling to believe that we can invent new ways of creating as much energy as coal, oil, and natural gas have provided, even though that's an extremely contentious claim. We see the problems created, such as global warming, you know, the loss of the ozone layer, all these things. And instead of asking a fundamental question, which is, should human beings adjust the way we interact in the world, lower our expectations for energy use and consumption, to try and bring our way of living back into some sort of balance with the larger world, that question is never really considered, and all that we talk about in the dominant culture is how to find new high-energy, high-technology solutions to the problems that high-energy, high-technology has created. And that may end up being the most dangerous fundamentalism. I think, you know, religious fundamentalism is dangerous. We see the negative consequences when people have an unthinking belief in the absolute righteousness of a religious system. We talked about the problems of market fundamentalism, of national fundamentalism. But with technological fundamentalism, unfortunately, we're not just talking about the inequality within the human family. We're talking about whether the human family can continue to live in any sustainable way on this planet. And so many of us are concerned that this reflexive technological fundamentalism, this belief that technology will always save us, whether that might end up being the most dangerous fundamentalism of them all.
I think in society we tend to be selective as to what we consider to be important. And one of the ways militarism has been able to advance is by creating this fear of the other in society. And who are the other? Those who we do not recognize being equal to us or similar to us, whether that be skin or language or, you know, whatever we define as different. What do we lose when we ignore inequity, injustice in the pursuit of our goals for development or an improved quality of life? What do we lose in the long run?
Well, I think the answer is quite simple. We lose our own humanity. Those of us in the first world who live relatively comfortable lives, at some level we know that the material comfort with which we live is built on the backs of people primarily in the global south, in the third world. And we know that's inconsistent with our own moral principles. We know it violates our concern for the fundamental dignity of all people and for equality. Yet the material comfort with which we live often allows us to ignore that. But I think when we do ignore that, in a very basic way, we lose some of our own humanity. And here, I think, is a place where traditional religion actually can help. Because if you think about whether it's Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, all of them are, at their core, I believe, are a call to recognize the universal nature of the human family. That is, all of them include principles that remind us that the value of my life, sitting here in the United States today, is of no greater or lesser value than the lives of people across the world. That person who might be living in sub-Saharan Africa on less than $2.50 a day, that person has the same moral value as I do, that person's child has the same moral value as my child. That is the universalizing call of religion, and it's clearly at the core of the Christian faith. Now, the problem, of course, is that religion can also be a way in which we distance ourselves from other human beings. That is, religion, although I think it is a call to the universal, also often leads people to draw the artificial boundaries you're talking about. Well, there's me and my group, the good Christians, and then there's all the sinners out in the world. And you can see how religion is, from my point of view, perverted to create barriers instead of break down those barriers. But again, I think that's why, for those of us who have an interest in struggling over the definition of Christianity and other faith traditions, we have a lot of work we can do not to invent a new religion, but simply to say it's time in the prophetic sense, that it's time to honor the true values of the religion, to honor that universal conception of the human family. All of that's within our grasp. There's a tradition, there's a text, there's a space that we call church where we can come together and do this. And I think that's, for me at least, the animating spirit behind my own interest in religion.
You, in your book, talk about power over in a dead world. What do you mean by power over, and what are the alternatives?
When we think about the question of power, in conventional terms, power is defined as the ability to make people do what they would otherwise not do. I have power over you, Sylvia, if I can make you do things you would otherwise not do. And that's what we tend to call power over. And of course, power over is real. It operates in the world. It often has disastrous consequences. But we can also think about power as power with. That is, my power is not over you. It's with you. It's in the collaborative, creative possibilities of you and I combining forces. And that's a different sense of power. That's the power, I think, that makes it possible to imagine a decent future. The power over, I believe, can lead only to a dead world. And I would make the argument right now that in the United States, given the values of this national fundamentalism and the market fundamentalism, often connected to a very reactionary religious fundamentalism, I would describe that as a dead culture, a culture that has no capacity to generate creativity and to generate life. All it can do is extract from others, which leads to death. So I know it sounds rather perhaps dramatic, but I really do think in many profound ways in the contemporary United States, we live in a dead culture, a culture that hangs on to ideas that are no longer consistent with reality, that hangs on to systems that are not consistent with a decent future. And I think we have to create something new. My own view is that that's not likely to happen in Washington, D.C. or on Wall Street in the centers of power. It's going to happen at the margins in places like Austin, Texas, where I live, where, you know, as we speak, we're working to acquire a building for a new community center. We're working to create some worker-owned cooperatives where people can control their own economic life. We're talking about resisting, you know, racism and sexism. We're talking about coming together in this sense of power with, not to control each other, but to try and find ways to create something new. And that's where I think the real hope for the future lies.
What do we need to create this new society that you describe?
Well, I think we need a 12-pack of beer and some barbecue. No, I'm kidding. That's the solution to everything in Texas. Just get a 12-pack of beer and some barbecue and everything will be fine. What does it take? Well, I think it takes, first of all, a kind of honesty to confront the very dire circumstances we find ourselves in. And beyond that, I think it takes a sense of hope. And by hope, I don't mean unrealistic, overly optimistic assessments. I think, you know, people have used the term a kind of stubborn hope, a hope that won't give up even when things are looking bleak. And I think we should tell the truth. Things do look pretty bleak in this country at the moment. Much of the population is in the grips of these fundamentalisms. Yet I think that we rescue our own humanity, especially those of us with privilege. And I have a lot of privilege. I'm white. I'm male. I'm professionally educated and employed. You know, the way I'm going to save my own humanity is not by holding on to my privilege or holding on to my resources. It's going to be coming into spaces where I willingly give up those resources in a collaboration with others. That's how we save ourselves. You know, sometimes people look at the political work I do and they think somehow I'm this very noble person. And the fact is I'm probably the most selfish human being I know. I do this work because I want to, in a sense, save my own life. I want to create or help create a world in which I can be fully human. And the world we live in right now does not allow that. The world we live in closes off so many avenues for us to express our own humanity. It keeps us trapped in the corporate world. It keeps us trapped in conventional politics. It keeps us trapped in a commodified commercial culture that is always telling us to buy, buy, buy.
I was speaking to a journalist from Honduras, Gerardo Torres. He's a young man who started a movement called Los Necios, the stubborn. And they speak precisely what you're talking about, this stubborn hope, this idea that although you are constantly told you don't have a right to have those dreams, he says we're going to have them and we're going to define those who tell us we do not have the right to pursue a society with dignity and, you know, just a decent quality of life. What inspires you? What inspires your work to continue to struggle?
Well, I can tell you that's very easy. What inspires me is the people like you just described. Here in Austin, I've been incredibly fortunate to work with people, often younger people, people from what we call traditionally minority communities, people from parts of society that are not as wealthy, and I watch them struggle against much greater obstacles than I face myself. And I see them struggling and struggling joyously. You know, as someone who's older and more established and materially in a much more comfortable position, what I've discovered is when I go to those people and say, I want to join you in your struggle. I want to commit my own time and resources to the projects that you have going, that, as I said, I benefit tremendously. This is what gives my own life meaning. It's what deepens my own sense of my own humanity. There's inspiration every time we turn the corner. We just have to be willing to see it.
Thank you so much for joining us. For people who want to read your book, All My Bones Shake is an amazing book. It really challenges to look at our values and our own beliefs and how they contribute or perpetuate a system of injustice and what can we do about it. So how can people access your book?
Well, the easiest way to find me, if you have access to a computer, is just to Google my name, Robert Jensen, and the first page that comes up will be mine.
Thank you again for joining us.
Great to be with you, Sylvia. Thanks.
Take care.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.